You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Talk Nation Radio.
Welcome to Talk Nation Radio, a half-hour discussion of politics as if the people mattered. I'm David Swanson. This week on Talk Nation Radio, we speak with a candidate for the office of prosecutor in Charlottesville, Virginia, who is campaigning against mass incarceration. And we speak with a student activist at American University in Washington, D.C., who is campaigning for justice in Palestine and against the militarization of U.S. police forces. It's my great privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Jeff Fogel. He is a candidate for Commonwealth's attorney here in Charlottesville, Virginia, in other words, prosecutor. After graduating from Rutgers Law School back in the year I was born, 1969, Jeff received a fellowship to work providing legal services to indigent residents of Newark. After several years, he left to become a highly touted criminal defense lawyer, and then to accomplish more, he went into civil rights practice and hoped to have a larger impact on the criminal justice system, which he is still trying to do and has been having for many years. He practiced in New Jersey, New York, Puerto Rico, and the last 10 years, Virginia. He's been executive and legal director of the ACLU of New Jersey and legal director of the Center for Constitutional Rights while teaching civil rights, civil liberties, and trial practice at Rutgers and at NYU School of Law. I could go on. Jeff Fogel, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David.
It's wonderful to have you on here, and it's wonderful that you're running for Commonwealth's attorney. I certainly would welcome any of your opponents on the program, but am going to be voting for you. What's your platform?
Well, my main concern, and I think that's been true now for a couple decades, along with many other people who've looked at the question, is mass incarceration and the inequitable distribution of that incarceration, specifically that African Americans are grossly overrepresented in the criminal justice system, to the point where, for example, here in Virginia, 60% of the prisoners are African American in a state where the population is 20%.
And how does
we've got a huge amount of people in prison who don't belong there, costing us a fortune. And we're actually harming ourselves in the process. People have to recognize that most people who go to jail actually get out, some of them within a few years. And after a short period of time, the prison becomes almost a laboratory for becoming more of a criminal. And so if we can keep people who otherwise would not continue to engage in criminal acts out of prison, we're going to be doing a lot better for everybody. So the focus, as I said, has been mass incarceration and racial disparities. So when you look at mass incarceration, you think about what's put us in this position so that the United States has increased its prison population by some 600% over the last three decades. Well, clearly one of the contributing factors is the war on drugs. And in that regard, what concerns me a lot is that the people of Charlottesville, like the people elsewhere, have no say, or at least to this point, in the extent to which their community participates in this war on drugs. We've got a drug task force that's gung-ho, part of the war on drugs, and it's not getting anybody anywhere. So we need to cut back. As I said, I would not prosecute mere possession of marijuana cases, and I would look at every other possession case or every other case where the person appeared to have been addicted to drugs and look for an alternative solution to the criminal justice system. We may need some more resources in terms of programs for addicts, but we certainly do have mental health services in the community. We do have some assistance for addicts, and we do have people who can assist in getting people houses and jobs and so on. We need to keep people out of that. Secondly, driving mass incarceration was the lengthy sentences that have been given out and increased over a period of time. One of the causes of that was the 1994 Crime Act, sometimes referred to as the Biden Crime Act, supported by Clinton, both of them, and a lot of other people in Congress, which gave billions of dollars to the states to build prisons so long as they instituted mandatory minimum sentences. I think there's a widespread recognition, both on the federal and state level, hasn't done anything for public safety and has caused a huge increase in the number of people remaining in prison and remaining there through their entire lives and costing us a fortune when it gets to geriatric care in the prisons, when there's no reason to be keeping people at that late stage. So we need to avoid bringing cases that involve mandatory minimum sentences, which we can do. We can find alternatives. We need to find cases. There are many cases where people only go to jail for a short time. Nonetheless, they're charged with a felony. Well, a felony will destroy your life. A misdemeanor won't. So we can come back and charge people with misdemeanors who don't have to be in a state prison, even if it requires a short term in jail. For example, I saw a case recently where somebody was sentenced to 102 years, a series of felonies, which were burglaries or break-ins, with all but 2 years suspended, meaning they were going to spend 2 years in jail and 100 years on probation. We don't need to tie up our probation services for 100 years for somebody like this. And then finally, the issue becomes how the sentencing goes. And, of course, if you charge people with the appropriate crime, instead of piling six or seven crimes on to one in order to force them to plead guilty, if you start off charging them with the appropriate crime, and even if they go to trial, there's only so much time that the judge or jury can give them. And we need to start reducing the average amount of time spent in prison if we're going to address the problem of mass incarceration. And then there are other elements involving racial justice, which have to be looked at very carefully. I've been fighting with the city now for 4 years to get access to the reports about stop and frisk. Well, in the context of being in the prosecutor's office, we'll take a very, very close look at every single case that involves a frisk and a search to see whether or not that search was lawful, whether the search was appropriate and proportionate to the level of the offense. And we'll look at every case involving our Drug Enforcement Task Force, particularly the cases involving informants and cases where they have tried to set up people who are simply addicts and try to change that culture and that philosophy. And if it can't be done by the police department, with the encouragement of the Commonwealth Attorney's Office, I believe it can be done. So it's basically looking at everything that is the source of mass incarceration, reducing the number of people going into the system, into the criminal justice system at all, and certainly having a significant impact on the number of people going to prison and the number of people charged with felonies as compared to misdemeanors. So that's basically the program.
It sounds like a smart program. It sounds fact-based rather than myth-based. What about the problem of bail, of how many people are behind bars before any trial or conviction whatsoever, and what can a prosecutor do about that?
Well, I'm glad you brought that up because that is another main issue. If you look at our own regional jail here in Charlottesville, you'll see that it's overcrowded, and that's largely as a result. Well, two concerns. One is state prisoners backed up because there's not enough room in the state prison system, and secondly, people in jail awaiting trial. And there are certainly many, many too many people in jail awaiting trial simply because they don't have the money for bail. Now, there's a variety of alternatives that can be put into place. There's a group out in Augusta County that's from California called Nexus, and they've actually raised money in order to put it up for poor defendants. That's one route to go. Another route to go, of course, is the prosecutor's office is in a position in every single case to argue what appropriate bail is. And this prosecutor's office, at least under me, will be very, very careful that nobody be held in jail simply because they cannot afford bail. That's just a system that is too punitive of people simply for being poor.
You also have said on your website, tell people your website, by the way, I don't remember the address.
It's Fogel, F-O-G-E-L, for CCA, that's Fogel for CCA, .us.
Fogel for CCA.us. You also say there that you want to assure that your office would be a death penalty free operation, and that you want to avoid, and presumably this sometimes involves threatening the death penalty, you want to avoid overcharging crimes in order to get plea bargains. Both sound very admirable, and of course I would love to see the death penalty abolished in the state of Virginia, but what sort of resources would be needed if more people actually went to trial? Because, you know, not everybody realizes, I think, that plea bargain is mostly what happens to most people.
Well, that's a very interesting question, but I would say that people who have instituted some similar programs elsewhere in the country have not seen a significant increase in the number of people going to trial. If you do your job, both the police department and the prosecutor's office, and you show your job. Now, in the state of Virginia, there's no obligation on the part of a prosecutor to show any evidence to the defendants. Of course, there's the federal constitution, which requires prosecutors to divulge any favorable information to the defendant, but often the prosecutor doesn't know what's maybe favorable to the defendant, not knowing what the defendant's defense is. So in our own city, they have what they call an open book policy, which is to say they do show defense lawyers some part of their file. They will not allow defense lawyers to copy it. But where I practiced law starting, 48 years ago, when I showed up at an arraignment in Newark, New Jersey, I was provided with the full file by the prosecutor's office. And it was just everybody knew this is not a sporting event. We have to share all the information we have because people have to remember there's a disparity in resources as well. The state has at its disposal a police department and a prosecutor's office. The defendant oftentimes has an appointed lawyer being paid very little money, or a public defender who's overworked. And so there already is a disproportionate amount of resources in the state side. So it's important that the state share that information. And my experience with being shared information as a defense lawyer was the more information you have that points to the guilt of your client, the more likely it is you're going to plead guilty. And even though we may not be giving out plea bargains as such, it certainly has an impact on what the sentencing is, both from the prosecutor's point of view and from a judge's point of view. So yeah. You can't control everything, but we can control an awful lot from the position of Commonwealth attorney.
There seems, Jeff, to have been this vicious cycle of understanding over recent decades in which news media choose to report on violent crimes and not to report on people's lives saved from or destroyed by unnecessary prosecution and unnecessarily harsh penalties. And that feeds a public understanding that the more lives you ruin, the more people you lock up for decades, the better off we are, which feeds the election of prosecutors who have that platform. Is it possible that Charlottesville's population is wise enough and somehow educated itself outside of mainstream U.S. communication systems that we'll vote for a wise policy? And would you, as prosecutor, have any means of getting, local media outlets to cover a different side of the story?
Well, I don't know about the ability to convince local media outlets, but I also get disturbed by the fact that every time somebody's arrested, their picture shows up in the paper. Now, I know the state law requires the police department to disclose that information, but there's certainly nothing that requires newspapers to publish it, and I look forward to sitting down with the top of their staffs in talking about why they need to publish it, because it seems to me it's inherently prejudicial against the person whose picture is out there who hasn't been convicted of anything. Now, if we're looking for somebody and they need to publish the picture, that's a very different question. But public safety has nothing to do with displaying pictures of everybody who's been arrested. And I think that leads to a perception that all of those people are guilty, and that that's really happening all the time, and we don't have any A, success stories, or B, disaster stories about the criminal justice system. For example, I saw a gentleman about 6 weeks ago.
Yeah, 30 seconds.
He was busted. It was the drug task force. They told him a small amount of drugs, $50 worth of cocaine. He spent a year in jail. They telling him that if he'll just talk, they'll get him out the next day. He gets acquitted. And he goes home. He doesn't have a job. His family went on welfare, food stamps, and so on. And his life is pretty much destroyed. And nobody gives a darn about him. So we have to look at the injustices of the criminal justice system as well as the injustice to the people of those who commit serious crimes, violent crimes, prey on the community, we do need to keep the community safe in that regard.
And we need those powers in the hands of someone with some restraint and thoughtfulness. Jeff Fogel, the website is fogel4cca.us. Thanks for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you, David, very much.
It is my privilege to welcome to Talk Nation Radio this week Ntebo Mokuena. She is a senior at American University and is majoring in political science with a gender, race, and politics concentration, along with a minor in art history and a certificate in women policy and political leadership. Phew. She was born and raised in the D.C. area and on campus is involved with Students for Justice in Palestine, which is a decentralized student group that supports the BDS movement and self-determination of Palestinians. The group is part of the Community Action and Social Justice Coalition. Very good to know that's happening at American University. Ntebo Mokuena, welcome to Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you.
So I ran into you at a forum that was on C-SPAN that we both spoke at related to gun violence, and I wanted to ask you about your activism related to police militarization and related to U.S.-Israel police exchanges. What can you tell me has been happening in recent weeks?
So, especially in the age of Trump, given that he's one of the most pro-Israel presidents this country's ever seen, it's really important for the general public to be aware of not only police violence in Israel, but the police exchange programs between the IDF and several U.S. police forces. So what I can tell you right now is that over 12 states, including the U.S. Capitol Police, have exchange programs with the IDF. This includes the Baltimore Police Department, in which Freddie Gray was killed in April 2015. A lot of these programs are privately and publicly funded. Some of the organizations which support financially police exchange programs are the Anti-Defamation League, American Jewish Committee's Project Interchange, and the Jewish Institute for National Security Affairs. And lastly, Georgia International Law Enforcement Exchange. And this is through Georgia State University. And so they have police exchanges between Georgia police and IDF. And so some of the things that are taught in these programs are Krav Maga, which is a defense system created by the IDF. And it's different from martial arts in that it takes some of the most brutal aspects of real martial arts and uses them to enforce violence on Palestinians and now U.S. citizens. So the parallels between the Black experience and the Palestinian experience with regards to police aren't abstract. It's very clear what's happening. Some other aspects of police exchange programs include border policing, prison operations, military and cybersecurity technologies, and urban policing. So, again, you can see how this has been implemented in the U.S. Unfortunately, these programs are pretty transparent, but there have been movements by pro-Palestinian activists to open up these programs, see what corporate and public ties these programs have, and to be more aware of what is actually happening in the training programs. And so, in addition to these exchange programs, the U.S. government gives over $3.8 billion in military aid to Israel. And so this includes helicopters, guns, bombs, you name it. And so seeing the rise of police militarization in the U.S., again, it's not abstract. These are the same weapons used here and abroad.
I don't know about you, Ntebo, but I've been a little bit encouraged in recent days by protests on behalf of refugees and immigrants, people actually expressing concern and taking risks for strangers unknown to themselves out of human sympathy. And I wonder if you see potential in this new era for growth in the boycott, divestment, sanctions campaign, in resistance to U.S. support for its own wars and wars by others, including all the billions of dollars of free weapons to Israel for its crimes. Is there an opportunity for expansion here?
I definitely think so. I've also felt similarly going to a few rallies downtown in D.C. I've seen a lot more pro-Palestine signs and seen many Palestinian flags, a lot more than I used to see at rallies. And I think people are starting to, you know, wake up and see what's happening in Israel and how similar it is to the U.S., what's happening here in the U.S. I'm really hoping that this is an opportunity for people to learn more about BDS and see how they can get involved. On campus, we have several events to help students and faculty learn more about Palestine. And so every year we have the Israeli Apartheid Week in March, and we're hoping that more students and faculty will get involved through that.
Do you think that a large section of the U.S. public is even aware of what you were talking about earlier, that, you know, as I understood it, numerous police departments involved in the crackdown against the public in Baltimore had officers trained by the Israeli military in Israel in war tactics. My little town here in Charlottesville, Virginia, I just learned this week, has essentially a tank, an armored vehicle, mine resistant for shooting people without the police inside getting shot themselves. You know, we're militarizing local police, and the Israeli military is involved in training them to act as if they're at war against us. Do you think people even know this? And people who want to learn about it, how can they learn about it? How can they get involved in resisting it?
So I agree. I feel like a lot of people don't know that this is happening, which is really unfortunate because it affects people's daily lives. And I think it's the responsibility of activists like you and I to make sure that we're disseminating this information. I think as often as we can, especially when we host events that are directly in response to the rise of Islamophobia and the Trump presidency, to make sure that we talk about what's happening and to make sure that on a local level, groups like parents' councils, you name it, unions know what's happening, because these are affecting U.S. citizens, but also people abroad. And as our country starts to really organize in resistance, it's really, really important. If people want to learn more on the internet, they can look at different Amnesty International and Human Rights Watch reports that talk about this. Even the U.S. Department of Justice has issued statements saying that the IDF uses excessive force and our own police forces use excessive force.
If you send me some of the best reports, we'll get them up with this show at talknationradio.org for people to link to. One of the things I appreciated about this event that we were both at AU was the mixture of ages and races and backgrounds of the people, not just the people speaking, but the people attending the conference. Because when I go to events against U.S. war making, they are almost always very white, very old, very wealthy, relatively speaking, events. But the people leading the efforts for Palestinian solidarity in the United States seem to be disproportionately younger and much more diverse than those. There seems to be this divide. So I wonder if you have any thoughts on how to bridge it and how to get the old white folks working against Israeli wars, and how to get young people active against U.S. wars.
I definitely hear you with that. I think as we talk more about intersectionality and the importance of elevating voices of most marginalized, I think intergenerational organizing becomes really important and very powerful. there's a lot to learn from the anti-war movement of our parents and grandparents. And so I think one of the best ways for this to happen is for campus organizations to partner with off-campus organizations, just like the anti-gun violence event that we attended. I think it's really important for pro-Palestine groups to partner with Jewish Voice for Peace and other older generation organizations. And I think one last way it's important is for more decentralized organizations like SJP to talk more about local politics and how we can affect change with regards to legislation, as the anti-BDS legislation is also on the rise.
Yeah, I got an email today about a couple of elderly Palestinian activists promoting themselves as survivors of the Nakba, planning a tour of events through the U.S. this spring. I hope things like that will help. But you mentioned that, and we just have a few minutes left, you mentioned that Donald Trump is one of the most pro-right-wing Israeli government presidents that the U.S. has had. How specifically should we go after resisting his agenda or that of his advisors or particular cabinet members? What should we do differently now?
I think what sets Donald Trump apart from a lot of our previous presidents is not only his explicit support for Israel and his own business ties with Israel, but the fact that he has led way to a very Islamophobic and fascist movement in the United States, the fact that he has this Muslim ban. And as we see, Israel and Palestine are often falsely conflated as a religious issue. And I think it's really important to combat that message, because it isn't a religious issue. At the root, it's a political issue, it's a land issue, it's a human rights issue. And so I think that is one way we can attack the rhetoric, that the pro-Israel rhetoric coming from the Trump cabinet. And I think another way is to strengthen our movement by working with other groups, such as environmental justice groups that also work to expose the issues of the Trump cabinet.
Very good. Ntebo Mokwena, you're with Students for Justice in Palestine. Is there a website for that?
Yes. Yeah, so we have a Facebook page. It's American University, just Students for Justice in Palestine. And we also have a Twitter handle, which is linked on our Facebook page. If you want any more information, feel free to message and like our Facebook page. We post events and different articles about what's happening here in the U.S. and in Israel.
Wonderful. We've been speaking with Ntebo Mokwena, a senior at American University and active with Students for Justice in Palestine. Thank you for pushing us old folks in the right direction. We'll get those links up at talknationradio.org. And thank you for coming on Talk Nation Radio.
Thank you for having me.
This is Talk Nation Radio. I'm David Swanson. Take action at rootsaction.org. Help end war at worldbeyondwar.org. All past shows can be heard at davidswanson.org. Talk Nation Radio is produced in Charlottesville, Virginia, and syndicated by Pacifica Network. If you are listening to a nonprofit station, please support that station. Talk Nation Radio is funded by contributors at davidswanson.org. There is no way to peace. Peace is the way.
This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
This is a deeply rooted cultural issue that goes back to a view around how people are treated, having a lot of wealth is not something that's flaunted or encouraged. It's discouraged. People are treated as equals, irrespective of what sort of job they may hold in society. And a willingness to finance that from a tax perspective and implement a fiscal policy that aligns with that cultural view.
When liberal politicians suggest we look for policymaking inspiration from social democracies in Europe, the automatic reaction from some corners of the American political scene is something like, well then, move to Sweden, or love it or leave it. But today, reflecting upon the millions of women, men, and children who participated in the historical march over the weekend, it's pretty clear that advocating for change is part of why we do love it. There's no reason that we can't take lessons from other systems in our collective pursuit of a more perfect union, not to mention a more healthy environment. This week on Sea Change Radio, we take a peek at how the Dutch do things. I speak with two American environmentalists based in the Netherlands to get their perspective on Holland's environmental policies and practices. Michael Payne, a wind energy and bicycle advocate, and Mike Fawcett, the founder of Farm Zero, join me to discuss the cultural, economic, and financial keys to Dutch sustainability. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Mike Fawcett and Michael Payne, coming to us live from the Netherlands. Michael and Mike, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Hi, Alex.
Hi, Alex.
We've had you both on the show in the past. You're both sustainability experts, and you're both expats, both Americans living in the Netherlands. First, why don't you give us kind of a little refresher on your backgrounds? So, Michael Payne, why don't you go first? Tell us a little bit about your background in the sustainability field, if you will.
Sure. Thanks, Alex. So I've lived in the Netherlands about 10 years in total now. Most of that time, I've been working in the utility scale wind industry, developing large projects in Europe and Asia. And in addition to that sort of perspective on how the world's evolving, I've spent the last 3 years running a bicycle advocacy organization in Houston, Texas. And they've just moved back to the Netherlands after doing that to try and help Houston move the peanut down the field and gradually become slightly more bicycle friendly, as the Dutch have managed to demonstrate to me and others in the world.
And you have a long history of working in the wind power industry as well, right?
Right. So prior to getting involved in urban development and bicycle advocacy, I spent about 15 years working in the wind industry in both the United States and then in Europe and Asia.
And Mike Fawcett, why don't you tell us what Farm Zero is and give us an executive summary of your sustainability background?
Sure, glad to. We started Farm Zero about 4 years ago, the commercial entity. And basically the objectives of the organization are to develop sustainable agriculture projects in parts of the world where it's really difficult or impossible to do agriculture, to do it well, and certainly to do it on a commercial basis. The foundation of the technology that we use uses seawater to cool and to humidify growing environments in the places that are otherwise difficult to do so because it's too hot or too dry or there isn't enough water. So we do that commercially in certain parts of the world. We're also now, having just developed a nonprofit foundation in December, doing nonprofit projects primarily at this point in the Horn of Africa, where using similar technologies, we are trying to do projects that can help to feed parts of the world that otherwise couldn't feed themselves, and to change the paradigm of how food aid gets to that part of the world. Rather than dropping a bag of rice on a community that can't feed itself, it's more a shift to helping these communities to develop agricultural projects that allow them to feed themselves and to do it over the long term.
So I wanted to have fun with this, but I think it could be educational. The basic thesis of today's show is, let's pretend that the Dutch Empire from the 17th century is back. The Dutch rule the world. Now, they're doing things a lot different, but they're doing things the way they do them today. There's no evil Dutch slavery colonization. They're the benign Netherlands that we know and love of today. So since both of you are not only in the sustainability space, but are keenly aware of the differences between how the U.S. goes about using its energy, how it designs its transportation, how it recycles, and how it's done in the Netherlands, we wanted to hypothesize on what if the Dutch ruled the world today? What would a walk down Central Park look like? Or what would my commute from my section of San Francisco down to the Embarcadero look like? How would our sustainability approach differ if the Dutch were the lone superpower in the world today?
I think it's a fascinating question, Alex, and it's something I've been discussing with my wife over the last sort of 5 years plus, and even going as far as kicking around the idea of what would that look like in terms of a book if we put a book together on that subject. And so you're forcing me to speak more deeply about the issue. From my perspective, I guess I see the Dutch culture as a couple of things. First and foremost, it's a culture that has a history of collaboration and cooperation within the society. And that goes as far as even referring to it as the polder model. And the polder, of course, is the land which has been recaptured from the sea. A large percentage of the Netherlands country used to be underwater due to population density and demand for more arable land. They built dikes. They designed and developed wind mills with an Archimedes screw technology, which would allow them to pump the water back over the dike into the ocean, draining what was then a lake, and then they would begin to farm the land. That doesn't happen when one person wants to do that by themselves. That happens when a community gets together and agrees that it's better for the common good to work together and achieve those results. And that concept is one which sort of pervades their way of decision-making, their way of urban planning, their way of allocating resources. And you see that in the country when you visit, and you see that in the quality of the infrastructure combined with a nice high marginal tax rate of 52% starting at 65,000 euros a year. That generates revenue, which they are then investing in a lot of different things, ranging from education to infrastructure to renewable energy to all sorts of support mechanisms to achieve the goals they seek to achieve. So I think that collaborative mindset is the starting point. And and just to sort of contrast that with sort of the opposite extreme of a culture, which you may see in a place like Texas, where the motto is more trust your neighbors, but brand your cattle. And, the lack of population density is the opposite extreme. People can do whatever they want to on their land. And, if it's you own it, then you it's your kingdom. And that's a very different perspective than what exists here. And maybe I'll just open with that first point and say, I think that concept is fundamental to addressing larger, more society-wide problems that exist both in the United States as well as around the world.
So, Michael, just following up on the polder model for a moment, that sounds like socialism, but the Dutch were some of the most successful capitalists in world history. How would you rectify those two seemingly discordant systems?
Yeah, I'm not exactly sure how they divided up the arable land in the olden days when they built the dikes and pumped the water back over the fence. But, there's no doubt that the Dutch are very commercially oriented people. They're one of the largest foreign, investors in other countries in the United States, in the UK and elsewhere. I mean, they've amassed tremendous resources, which they're investing globally to support a high quality of life in what is a relatively small country. So I don't think you're accepting a socialist government controls the income of the people approach in doing that, but there's no doubt that it forces a greater respect for income distribution, and there's no question about that.
So Mike Fawcett,
let's think a little more anecdotally and less from a macro standpoint. What were some of the starkest contrasts for you from a sustainability perspective when you moved from the U.S. to the Netherlands?
Well, certainly one of the first things that you're going to encounter is that there are bikes everywhere, that everyone in this country, if they can, bikes everywhere they can. And you will see children piled onto the front and back of bikes of their moms and their dads on the way to school when they're very young, or they will be biking themselves long distances to go to school or to work, because that's the way that folks here deal with that specific issue. They don't take cars if they don't have to. Public transport is generally the best option. If you're heading from one city to another, and the public transportation works so extremely well that you could set your clock by it. I think the level and the extent to which people are doing the recycling of a variety of different of recyclable materials is happening to an extraordinary extent, at least in the region in which we're living. This has been privatized. It's not being done directly by the government. So the efficiencies of the private sector come into play. We've had two or three different private organizations that are running the recycling in the region that I'm living in. And each time they have improved the way in which they're doing things, and they've become quite profitable just by collecting the waste from the various households in the area in which we're living. And this moves all the way from everything that you would throw out ordinarily to the green composting type stuff that you'd get just from doing your yard work. And that all goes into a single facility that deals with that at the at a pretty fundamental level. And it's the same for things like batteries and toxics that you'd otherwise face and find in landfills all across the states that now, at least here, are not being put into the landfills. So, you know, the toxicity issues are very low. Things like agriculture and farming, we're not dealing with a whole lot of GMOs because the EU doesn't allow them, but the extent to which GMOs generally crank up the levels of pesticides mean that the pesticide levels, at least here in the Netherlands and throughout much of Europe generally, are far lower than you would see in the US, which means effluent going into our waterways are lower, the toxicity of the waters are quite low, so that the water quality generally is quite high. It's very drinkable and very tasty. Those are a wide range of things that you, on a daily basis, I think, would see and say, well, this is pretty great. It's kind of extraordinary.
Sad eyed lady of the lowlands, where the sad eyed prophet say that no man comes. Now, should I leave them by your gate? Oh, sad-eyed lady, should I wait?
To listen to Sea Change Radio anytime, anyplace, just subscribe to our free podcast. Simply follow the link from seachangeradio.com or search for us in the iTunes podcast directory.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm having a group discussion with Michael Payne, a wind energy expert, and Mike Fawcett, the founder of Farm Zero. Michael Payne, maybe you can speak to the behind-the-scenes energy production side of things, since you've worked in that area for several decades.
Yeah, I'm happy to try to. In terms of renewable energy, obviously, as Mike Fawcett mentioned, that the Netherlands is at high risk to changes in sea level. And so very early on, they signed on with the European Union to work towards a goal of achieving 20% of its energy from renewable sources by 2020. They've been building onshore wind farms. They've been building solar installations. They're building offshore wind projects as well, which, of course, is a step change in terms of the complexity and the cost. And you know, they're just, you know, effectively getting on with it in a way that we haven't been able to do on a federal level in the United States. Well, you know, whereas some of the states have passed legislation and have made progress on a national level, we have not been able to achieve consensus on the right way to approach that. So, you know, they're absolutely serious about it. In terms of, you know, the other issue is just energy prices and energy taxes. So when we first, you know, came to the Netherlands and, you know, over the earlier years, say 10 years ago, 5 years ago, the price of a gallon of gasoline then with the current exchange rate was over $10 a gallon. That in itself, you know, which is largely taxes, is a signal which incents the consumer to change their behavior. Now, the exchange rate has dropped dramatically since then, is almost a 1-to-1 euro to the dollar exchange rate, but it's still, you're talking $6.50 or so a gallon of gasoline, which you pay every time you fill up your car. And then in addition to that, you know, for the privilege of owning and driving a car, you pay road use taxes, which are based on the amount of grams of CO2 per kilometer that your car generates. So we're not really at the level of understanding and knowledge, you know, to be even talking about how many grams of CO2 per mile or per kilometer our cars generate. But you need to, because you can't manage things that you can't measure. And if we're not talking about that, if we're not talking about our individual carbon footprints in the United States, then we're going to have a hard time, you know, making adjustments or managing them. So, you know, they're taking real steps to quantify and manage the issues that are associated with our children's future and our children's children's future.
The Dutch railway industry now has also mentioned that within the next couple of years, it will be run solely on renewable energy.
They have passed legislation in the House now in the Netherlands prohibiting the sale of gasoline-fueled or diesel-fueled automobiles after 2025. So, you know, you're talking about a country which is committed to making the transition to electric mobility, and they've already put the legislation in place to make that happen. If you want to operate a taxi at the largest airport in the country, Schiphol, one of the most important airports in Europe, you have to have an electric vehicle in order to do that. So you come out of Schiphol, you're going to be getting in an electric taxi. But that's the only way you can operate a taxi there. So this commitment to electrification is major. They're actually, you know, one of the first countries, and first Amsterdam has recently announced they're shutting off natural gas service to like 5,000 residences as the first step in a transition to shut off all the natural gas in individual homes. As an effort to reduce carbon emissions and be more efficient through the supply of heat and energy for cooking through electricity rather than natural gas. So, you know, these are major steps, and this is a natural gas producing country. Keep in mind, they have major natural gas supplies in the country themselves, which they'll use to generate electricity, but, you know, they don't feel it's most efficient to pipe it into people's houses. Even when the infrastructure has already been paid for, they're going to, you know, just write that off.
We haven't really branched out into our imaginary world where the Dutch control many other countries. So many people would say, well, this is all fine and dandy. The Netherlands can do this because they don't have gross inequality. They don't have severe poverty. They're a small country physically. Everyone can bike everywhere. What if we had this same kind of government without the climate deniers here in the United States, for example? What would be some of the first steps that a Netherlands-backed government could realistically implement to improve the way we approach sustainability here in the U.S.?
Well, I think, Alex, the first thing you'd have to assume is that they would not implement the Polder model. They would just, as a dictator, apply their own decision-making process to the United States rather than ask people in the various states what they would like to see happen. Because, you know, let's just take the issue of urban planning. And, you know, when you come into the large airport on the outskirts of your city, whichever city you may be talking about, you land and you get in your dirtbag taxi and start heading down the highway, which is, you know, lined by small strip malls and strip joints. you know, they don't allow that here. So from an urban planning perspective, land use is heavily regulated. And so what you could say, and you would get the cry from the real estate owners, you're depressing the value of my land by forcing me to keep all of this land along the side of the highway agricultural. Their argument would be, well, that will be more beautiful for everyone. We'll keep the people in the cities. The higher urban densities will be more efficient to supply in terms of transportation infrastructure, as well as energy infrastructure and everything else that goes along with it. That will be more cost effective and it'll be more beautiful for us. So, you know, get used to that change. And I think you'll like it as you do get used to it.
So a longer term view.
Correct.
That landowner who owns the strip mall property that didn't get to turned into a strip mall in this example would actually benefit in the long term, because that property would be at a premium if it's a more livable place. Is that
well?
Kind
it may
of the
never
idea?
Be zoned. It may never be zoned residential or commercial. I mean, you know, I think you know what you see in the Netherlands as you drive between cities is, even though it's the most densely populated country in Europe, you don't feel that here. You drive through green spaces. It's aesthetically very pleasing. And the reality is that they're just not planning on developing that land anytime in the near future. So, you know, if you want to, you know, build something new, then you need to, you know, you need to go to an area that's been zoned appropriately and it's going to be closer to the population centers.
In the port of Amsterdam, there's a sailor who sings of the dreams that he brings from the wide open sea. In the port of Amsterdam, there's a sailor who sleeps while the river bank weeps to the old willow tree. In the port of Amsterdam, there's a sailor who dies, full of beer, full of cries, in a drunken town fight. In the port of Amsterdam, there's a sailor.
Follow the shift to sustainability with Sea Change Radio on Twitter at twitter.com/SeaChangeRadio and on our Facebook page.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio. I'm speaking to both Michael Payne and Mike Fawcett from the Netherlands. Maybe, Mike Fawcett, you can speak to how the political process works there. If there was a creeping right wing similar to what we have in the U.S., which is now dominating the political process, would it be able to inject itself into the public debate? It seems like there's such uniformity in terms of rational policy making.
Yeah, it's a great question. And the reality is it would have a difficult time injecting itself into the debate in the same way that it does in the U.S. We have our own homegrown Donald Trump here in the Netherlands. He's actually been doing the Trump thing for a lot longer than Trump has. His name is Geert Wilders, and he's a guy who has been around for a very long time, talking a lot about Islamization of Europe and about the challenges that Islam presents to communities in Western Europe. And so there is an awful lot of that going on. The challenge for a party like his, which at the moment, if we were to have a vote in the Netherlands, which is coming up soon, the challenge for his party is that he has to get enough of the other parties in the Netherlands to work with him. He can't by himself have a controlling interest, as it were, in the policy of the country based solely on the fact that his party is the largest. He has to have a coalition government work together with him in order to be able to implement the policies and his objectives. The problem is that he has to have enough seats in the parliament in order to be able to do this. And the other challenge is that none of the other parties want to work with him. So the ability for his right-wing organization to really get the bully pulpit and do the things that it wants to do without the assistance of the other parties is virtually impossible. So even though the largest party in the Netherlands would essentially win the next election. They won't be part of the ruling government because no one's willing to work with them. So if you're too far in one direction or too far in another direction, your ability to essentially manage the government in the way that would be possible in the U.S. disappears.
And as we see, if you're moderate there, you're completely way out on the left wing in the U.S., the equivalent of what you're talking about as a moderate Dutch politician. What would you attribute that to, Michael Payne?
My answer is that this is a deeply rooted cultural issue that goes back to a view around how people are treated. I would go as far as it ties back into the religious history of the country and almost into sort of the Protestant perspective, where having a lot of wealth is not something that's flaunted or encouraged. It's discouraged, where people are treated as equals, irrespective of what sort of job they may hold in society, and a willingness to finance that from a tax perspective and implement a fiscal policy that aligns with that cultural view. I don't know how others would answer it, but that would be my perspective on it, that it's deeply rooted.
So, Michael Payne, you worked in bicycle advocacy in Houston, and Mike Fawcett, you had mentioned how you'll see bikes loaded up with families riding around. That doesn't sound very safe, but I've biked in the Netherlands. It's an incredibly easy place to bicycle. This is not something that just happened, though. There was incredible forethought into the planning of this. Why don't you speak to that, Michael Payne?
Fundamentally, the culture has embraced safe cycling, you know, from top to bottom, you know, beginning with the education of children in schools about how to ride safely. So, you know, in addition to getting it from your parents, you're learning safe cycling at school. And, you know, they take safety seriously. They teach kids how to swim here. Everyone's required to learn how to swim as well because of the canals that are so pervasive, and because the dams, you know, and being living below sea level, you know, in the 50s, the dikes failed and 2,000 people drowned, you know, at a point as well. So that, you know, safety is paramount in terms of education, in terms of the infrastructure they're developing. They're building separated bikeways where the cyclist has their own space to ride. It's designed carefully. Cyclists have right-of-ways at roundabouts. You know, lots of great examples of well thought out infrastructure. When there are fatalities, they don't just take the body and throw it in the van and drive off like they do in the United States and keep going. And, you know, that information never gets through to the planning department or to the public works department in the public cities and the city governments in the United States. Here, they spend a lot of time and energy understanding what went wrong at that particular intersection and determining whether or not improvements could be made to avoid fatalities in the future. And then they make the changes. So, you know, I think it's a comprehensive approach which covers education, infrastructure, laws, and the enforcement of the laws that make it safe and make it a really enjoyable place for people to get out and use their bikes year-round. I mean, it's great to see.
Michael Payne, Mike Fawcett, thanks so much for being my guests on Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex.
Thank you.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
It's hardly a newscast these days without weather porn. In January 2017, it was Houston flooding, mudslides in California, and an Oregon town or two with canoes in the streets. Over 230 Americans have died in flooding since 2015. Many more perished around the world as extreme precipitation events pop up on every continent. But what if extreme precipitation gets even worse as the world warms? What if rains beyond our experience swamp the infrastructure of cities or wipes out crops? A new study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences seems to predict that is exactly what will happen. Our guest is the lead author, Dr. J. David Nealon. He's a professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences at the University of California in Los Angeles. Nealon has published over 150 papers during the past few decades. David Nealon is a fellow of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and the American Geophysical Union. He leads UCLA's Climate Systems Interaction Group. David Nealon, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you. Glad to be on.
Well, you've done such deep research into both atmospheric science and the behavior of oceans, it's tempting to say you're a kind of hybrid specialist. Is that true?
Yeah, my group first made its name working on El Nino and taking apart why we get these warm and cold events down the Pacific every 2 to 5 years, typically, and some of the implications of that. And this is an example where universities figured out a phenomenon, and then that got turned over to the National Weather Service, among other places, for routine forecasts that we now have, some of which are right and some of which occasionally are off.
Well, that's the way weather forecasting goes. Now, to prepare the stage for our conversation today, there have already been papers looking into the relationship of extreme precipitation and a warming world. And I'm thinking of the work by Dr. Paul A. O'Gorman, for example, or Lehmann's paper from the Potsdam Institute in Germany that was titled Increased Record-Breaking Precipitation Events Under Global Warming. David, what sets your new paper apart?
Yes, it's important to situate this in a long track record of work on precipitation and how we project based on climate models that will change in the future, and also work on trends in extreme precipitation that have occurred over the past decades. So it's not a new thing to say that the extremes of precipitation are going to increase. What we looked at specifically is accumulations of precipitation from when you start raining to when you stop raining. So precipitation accumulations, and that would be in millimeters if you're a scientist, in inches if you're an American. And one of the questions has been that if the intensity of rainfall increases, so you get more millimeters in an hour, do you rain shorter, or do you keep raining and get more rain over the course of the event? And our study specifically addresses that, sure enough, you accumulate more over the course of an event. And we did two things. We were looking at a theoretical point of view where we can derive some things from the moisture equation of the atmosphere, governing how much moisture you have in the atmosphere. That in the first place, we were just interested in explaining something in current observations. And as we were doing it, we realized that this implied that the accumulation should increase in a rather specific way. The probabilities of large accumulations should increase in a rather specific way under global warming. It's consistent with what you expect from the work on intensities or daily averaged rainfall that's happened. And it puts another piece in the puzzle.
What I found different in this work, and really I had to work through two stages to understand it, and the first is the principle that there's been a limit to the amount of rain that can fall from the sky in a certain period, and you call that a cutoff point, and sounds like a good thing, maybe nature's way of keeping us from drowning. Can you explain what those limits are?
Sure. So if you think about your accumulations, how much rainfall fell from when you first felt that drop of rain to when it's not necessarily the sky cleared up, but it was no longer raining, you put down your umbrella. It's really common to have, say, an event in which a fraction of a millimeter would fall. And then if you go up to an event where the accumulation would be, say, a couple of millimeters, that's still pretty probable, maybe a little less than a tenth is probable. And then you go up another factor of 10, you know, to 10 millimeters, that's substantially less probable. But still, you know, you're going down by about a factor of 10, a little more than a factor of 10 each time you go up to the factor of 10 larger event. That's known as a power law. And then at a certain scale, certain number of millimeters that's typical for each region on the planet, the tropics would be different than, say, mid-latitude North America, you reach a scale at which your probability starts to drop about exponentially, i.e. pretty fast. So your number of events you experience larger than that cutoff is much, much less probable than the range of occurrences that you would get on the smaller accumulations.
Well, then comes the second stage, and this is really the worrying part, is that this cutoff limit will change as the world warms. Could you tell us about that?
Yep, and it's essentially taking things that are already known and twisting them to apply specifically to this accumulations, how much falls in a given event. You have a certain amount of moisture variability in the atmosphere. The large-scale motion of the atmosphere is converging moisture, and that tends you to drive you up till you get to high enough moisture that you start raining out. And what we found is that the range of the smaller events is governed by the statistics of those moisture convergence fluctuations. And then you get up to a point where the amount of rain that you have dropped out really enters into the equations, and that sets the scale for any given region. So it's a trade-off between these fluctuations and the fact that you're raining, you're losing water from the atmosphere. As you increase the amount of water vapor that's in the atmosphere, you tend to increase the size of those moisture fluctuations, and that pushes your range where your probability of larger events drops slowly up to a slightly higher value. Your cutoff occurs at a higher value.
Well, I can remember a couple of years ago, Great Britain was hit with a string of superstorms, and drainage systems that worked since Victorian times completely failed, and some villages that hadn't flooded since the Middle Ages went under. So, David Neelan, are you saying we can expect to see more record rains in parts of the world?
Yes, this is what this is saying. And it's consistent with, you know, quite a number of other studies that have looked at this from different point of views. So it's putting another piece in this puzzle with a little more theoretical underpinning, and then a rather large ensemble of climate model simulations to look at the way that this does change in a full complex climate model that includes representations of all the weather events that you would have.
And there's a word in your paper I had to revisit because it's not something we use every day. If we want to grasp what precipitation modeling can and can't do, we can't avoid that term stochastic. What does stochastic mean, and how does that affect your work?
Yes. So stochastic essentially means a process that you're representing as having a random component, one where you can't predict the precise fluctuations from moment to moment, although you are able to say things about the statistics. And we borrowed a big chunk of theory from the physics literature that uses these stochastic processes. And we use this to make statements about the way the statistics of extreme rainfall will change, even though you don't expect to be able to predict a century in advance the exact weather patterns. You're treating those as effectively random on timescales longer than a week or so, but you're still looking at the way that their statistics will evolve. And that was used in the theoretical prediction part of the study. And I have to say that theory was motivated by just understanding observations we had made using the Department of Energy has these wonderful data sets from high-resolution measurements of rainfall at many places in the world. And that's where we were first noticing this rather simple distribution of probabilities of the accumulations. They were, in observations, having this slow drop as you went up, each factor of 10 in size, and then this fast drop. And so when we were explaining that using the stochastic model, we realized that there were these implications for global warming. We went and took the National Center for Atmospheric Research large climate model and ran 15 runs in normal climate of 30 years each, and then 15 runs in a high greenhouse gas scenario for future climate, and looked at the differences between the accumulations in those future scenario runs versus the current runs, the current historical greenhouse gas runs.
You know, I really appreciated that explanation. I've understood your paper better for hearing that. I've noticed that the arrival of extreme precipitation events has been very uneven. The Potsdam Institute reports Hazardous rain increased by about 12% globally, but in Southeast Asia, the increase was 56%. Why are some regions magnets for extreme precipitation, like the U.S. Deep South, while others are not?
Some of that has to do with the particular types of weather system that they get in each region and the ways that that can change. So if you, for instance, have a change in the timing of your deep convective rainfall of a monsoon system, for example, that changes in a way that can potentially be slightly different than our mid-latitude rainfall that comes from frontal systems. But we have to say we don't understand everything about the regional changes at this point. You're essentially, when you're asking questions about global warming, the question of is the planet warming when you put increased infrared radiation trapping gases in the atmosphere, that one's relatively easy. The question of, you know, exactly for my specific region, how is the rainfall going to change in this particular year, that's a tougher one. So we tend to make these statements that apply across broad regions.
Well, you know, just for fun, I looked up the largest amount of rain that's fallen in any American state since records began, and it was 42 inches over a meter of rain that fell in 24 hours in Texas. That was in July 1979. But it turns out measuring rainfall isn't as easy as it sounds. There are things that can distort the whole process. What are the best tools now for counting how much rain falls in a particular place or region?
So there's a number of measurement methods. There's various types of local rain gauge, from things that are essentially glorified buckets with careful wind sheltering and so on, to optical gauges that count how many raindrops are falling past a sensor. And those are at the ground-based station level. And then there's a large investment in satellite technology for measuring rainfall from space. Those are always estimates based on the amount of raindrops and their effects on the either microwave radiation coming up from the clouds, for instance, or in some cases we have space-based radar on satellites that essentially ping and look at the hydrometeors in the clouds and estimate the rain rate from that. And the satellites have great spatial coverage, and then you're typically checking them against the ground-based observations to calibrate the rates. You like to make statements when you're doing things from observations that combine all of these data sets.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith, and our guest David Nealon was educated at the University of Toronto before getting his doctorate from Princeton. He's been at the University of California, Los Angeles for quite a while, and we're talking about new science showing extreme precipitation is coming as we disrupt the climate. Well, it seems to me you're beyond just using computer models. You're expert enough to evaluate different models and their shortcomings. Some people are suspicious of computer modeling and climate science. How can we have some confidence in the work that you've done?
So one of the significant things that I, for instance, always tell my students is you don't necessarily want to put all your faith in one single study, and certainly not in one single model run or one single set of observations. You're always looking at an aggregate of multiple studies by multiple groups on the same thing. And in the case of the increases in precipitation, that's why I was mentioning the background of multiple other research groups that have looked at this both in observational trends and in predictions from the climate models over the, basically now we're talking about almost two decades that this has been looked at. And so we're gradually making our statements with increasing confidence about the increased probability of very large precipitation events.
Looking back through your past papers, it's a pretty impressive work. You've gone into such large and complicated problems, and my guess is that only grad students can really carry on those kinds of conversations. If you go to a party and somebody asks what you do for a living, David, what do you tell them?
At first I would tell them about El Nino, which sort of hit the public scene around 1997, more than a decade after we started working on it. Now, if you tell them you're a climate scientist, they have plenty of things to ask you about, so that's not really a problem. I teach a undergraduate class in climate modeling and climate change that started out maybe 15 years ago with 7 students and now has to be capped at 120. So this is definitely something that you can talk about at the undergraduate level. And I sort of pride myself with being able to have conversations on this across the political spectrum. I find if you calmly explain what you know and why you know it, that people listen, people get it, at least in one-on-one conversation.
Okay, well, to me, this is really jaw-dropping science. I mean, destructive and deadly rains are coming as we alter the atmosphere. How do you feel about it?
I do want to put some perspective on this in that the changes in probability of a really large event that we're, for instance, finding in the climate model, they're increasing by hundreds of percent by the end of the century under a scenario where we do little to limit the emissions of greenhouse gas. If you limit the emissions of greenhouse gas, you would limit the increase in the probability of these large events. And I'm an optimist. It's taking a long time. The first big study that came out on global warming summarizing the existing science was in 1979. So it's been a long road, but there's much more awareness now. And even if one could wish for faster action, I do have confidence that society as a whole, people will step up and do sensible things to evolve our energy infrastructure over time and invest in cleaner technology.
Well, you must have several research balls juggling in the air at any particular time. David Neelan, could you talk to us about what you're working on now or hope to tackle in the near future?
So we have a lot of research on the fundamentals of precipitation processes. And one of the things that one is always working at is improving the way climate models simulate this, and weather model forecast models for that matter. At this point, the weather forecast models and the climate models are very, very closely related to each other. So we work back and forth. As I mentioned, we do some theoretical work, but we also have a big observational effort where, for instance, we're taking data from Department of Energy field programs, for example, or many of the satellite data sets that are now available from NASA and NOAA satellites. And we're scrutinizing in a detailed level exactly how the precipitation onsets when you have a given temperature and moisture structure in the atmosphere, for instance, with an aim of using this to fine-tune, improve the representations of these processes in the climate models.
And what does the Climate Systems Interaction Group at UCLA do, and what sort of computing power do you have available to you?
So one of the great things is that the National Center for Atmospheric Research, among other institutions, as well as some of the Department of Energy laboratories, they maintain large supercomputer infrastructure, and you can apply for time on that, computing time on that. So we do most of our big computing using collaborative computing infrastructure, and collaborative models that have hundreds of scientists contributing to their maintenance and improvement. So you can have a graduate student hop on to a very sophisticated climate model like the National Center for Atmospheric Research model and be able to modify the particular thing that they want to improve and get a run going without having to individually maintain that infrastructure.
Well, you don't have to answer this next question, but I'm wondering, you say you're an optimist. Do you think the new Trump administration will succeed in dampening American climate research to any degree?
My graduate students have been asking the same thing. So, you know, I like to think that sensible, when it comes down to it, people tend to make sensible decisions. And so I'm optimistic that there'll still be room for research. By and large, the U.S. has been fairly good about not having politics interfere at the level of scientific research over the past, and I'm hoping that some of that continues. In any case, even if society makes decisions to not move quickly to limit greenhouse gas emissions, that's a decision society can make. We're in a democracy, and the climate scientist's job will only become more important if we decide to do more rapid global warming than we have been, because we'll need to know with more precision what those consequences are going to be that we will have to adapt to.
Well, and my feeling, too, is that American climate science has been pretty advanced. I mean, there's great science in other parts of the world. We know that. But American scientists have led in many fields. And I think there's so much momentum in that that I don't think a four-year term, and I'm hoping that's what it might be, can really draw the strings on that, can really slow it down that much. And if it does, it'll bounce back very quickly.
One of the other things that is worth mentioning is that climate science isn't just about global warming. You know, for instance, I mentioned much of my early work was on El Nino and its consequences, and that's a natural climate variation. Much of the statements about extreme rainfall and, for instance, the work to improve weather and climate models, that is every bit as useful for weather prediction, which has, you know, substantial use to people across society. They're the same tools of the same graduate students working on these natural climate variations as are looking at, okay, what happens to these weather variations when you warm the climate? There's no distinction because you're working on the same phenomenon and how it tilts under natural variability or how it tilts under human-induced climate change.
All right, we're going to have to wrap this up. Is there anything else you'd like to say to our listeners?
One of the interesting research frontiers at the moment is one of attribution of probability of specific events to climate change. That's something that you'll be hearing more and more in the news, and it's worth taking a listen to that. These are early days in that. My group is not directly engaged in that, but we know groups that are, and we know the tools that they use. And that's as we move forward more and more into the warming era. You know, we just had another record for the global average temperature this past year in 2016, and there's every reason to think that that will keep going. That thinking about how this is impacting specific groups in society, who is in harm's way when you have a greater probability of a flood event, when the 1-in-100-year event becomes a 1-in-20-year event, what are the consequences of that? Those are things that it's worth paying attention to from a point of view of adapting your infrastructure, what municipalities need to do to invest in their infrastructure, what are the business impacts, opportunities, and risks. Those are all things where it's worth listening carefully to what's being said.
We've been discussing the paper, Global Warming, Precipitation Accumulation Increases Above the Current Climate Cutoff Scale. The lead author is Professor J. David Nealon from the University of California. This paper contains a warning about precipitation events getting even more extreme as we warm the planet. You can find links to the science we've discussed and to Dr. Nealon and his lab in my show blog at ecoshock.org. David Nealon, thank you so much for sharing your time with us on Radio EcoShock.
Thanks for having me.
I'm Alex Smith reporting.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock.
Normally, I introduce our guest. It's the polite thing to do. And this time, though, I will first ask a question to keep our climate listeners tuned in. Several Radio EcoShock supporters suggest I go easy on the nuclear power industry. Maybe we should keep the existing old reactors going as long as we can to avoid burning more fossil fuels. Even if one reactor blows in America or Europe, says one of my correspondents, the impact and the number of dead will be far less than the millions of all species who will die in a rapid climate shift. So there's the question. Should we keep old reactors going to reduce our damage to the atmosphere? Mystery guest, what do you say?
Definitely not. Building nukes and even keeping the old ones running actually is going to make climate change worse.
All right. Well, we're going to get into the details of why that is. And for those who don't know already, we're talking with nuclear engineer Arne Gundersen. All through the Fukushima nuclear tragedy and some close calls in America, Arne has been our repeat guest on Radio EcoShock. He's an expert who testifies in court cases connected to nuclear power. He's been in the nuclear industry. He knows how it operates. Arne is the chief engineer and scientist for the nuclear education agency, Fairwinds.org, founded by his wife, Maggie Gundersen. Arne, a warm welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hey, it's nice to be back, Alex.
Well, I really appreciate talking with you again, even though it's kind of a tough subject every time we do talk. You know, a little later we'll have our necessary chat about Donald Trump, but first let's talk about another disaster that's been around for a little bit longer. Please tell us about your trip to Fukushima, Japan in 2016.
Oh, yes. I was there just about a year ago today, and I spent a month collecting data. It was exciting because it was crowdsourced. We had individuals help pay for my plane fare over, and then the Japanese paid for my lodging and things like that. So it was truly a worldwide effort to get some good data. I guess the single biggest impression I come away with is the gross inhumanity of the Japanese government to their own people. They are in this to keep Tokyo Electric alive. They're in it for the industrial sector. Let's get these old nukes back online so the banks can make money. But they are not in it for the people of Japan. An example is I met a doctor who was filling out forms. He ran a clinic in Fukushima, and he was diagnosing people with radiation illnesses. And they refused to pay unless he changed the diagnosis to stress. And if he wrote down that these people, their hair was falling out, or they had bloody noses, or their skin was all blotchy because they were under stress, they would pay him. This guy had integrity, and he said, no, I'd rather close my clinic than do that. I had many people come to me. One woman, her hair fell out, bloody nose for 2 months, splotches all over her body, and she went to a doctor who said, don't worry, it's just stress. I'm sorry, bloody noses for 2 months, your hair falling out is not stress, it's radiation. So the inhumanity of the Japanese government to its own people is my single biggest takeaway.
Do you think it's safe to hold the Olympic Games at Fukushima City in 2020, or does that matter compared to what you've just described, the lifelong suffering exposure suffered by many Japanese people?
I think you hit the nail on the head. The contamination in the Fukushima prefecture is significant. And apparently they're going to do the baseball games in Fukushima prefecture, not all the Olympics. But so here you have elite athletes who are going to be there for 2 weeks. And if we worry about those guys, and we should, I found significant contamination wherever I went, but we should worry about them. But what about the people who have been there for the last 9 years living in this 24/7, 365? So I think it's a little callous on our part to be worried about the elite American athletes for a couple of weeks when the focus really should be on, people who are essentially trapped there.
Well, you've written and spoken about the Japanese efforts to try and filter out hot radiation, ultra-hot radiation, as they process the water that's running right through that site. They've got a massive tank farm. What's happening with that?
Well, they still have a massive tank farm. what they're doing, the tanks are loaded with lots of radioactive material. Especially what I'm worried about is cesium and strontium, but there's a witch's brew in those tanks. And what they're proposing to do is run that through a filter, which may get 90 to 95% of those isotopes, and then take the remaining contents of the tank and dump it in the Pacific. Now, the thing you can't filter out is tritium. And the tritium in those tanks is also huge. Tritium is identical to water, so it can't be filtered. So they're going to try to strip out the cesium and the strontium and then just discharge the rest to the Pacific. And to their credit, the Japanese fishermen aren't buying it. More and more now they're being bought off by the government to allow the dumping to occur. But in my mind, it's unconscionable to do that.
But hey, I live on the other side of that same Pacific Ocean, and I don't seem to get a say about whether they go ahead and dump their nuclear waste into it.
Yeah. When I went to school, the saying was dilution is the solution to pollution. And that's what the Japanese believe. You know, if they dump it on their side and it floats over to the west coast of the U.S., the Pacific's a big place. It'll dilute out. I don't think that's appropriate, and I've spoken about that at length, but people are going to die. You know, there's regardless of how low the radiation is, it does cause cellular damage and cancers. So if you spread it out in a big body of water, the concentration goes down. But on the other hand, you've got a couple billion people exposed to it because they're on the edge of that big body of water. So the concentration's down, but the population's up, and you're still going to get cancer. It's inevitable.
Well, super dangerous plutonium blew up with reactor number 3 at Fukushima, and I presume that's because the Japanese, like the British and the French, experimented with burning plutonium as a nuclear fuel. Arnie, what's happened with the multi-billion-dollar breeder reactor at Monju, Japan?
Well, first off, all the nuclear reactors in Fukushima had plutonium in them. A nuclear reactor creates about 500 pounds of plutonium a year. So, you know, Unit 1 had been running for a couple of years, so there was 1,000 pounds of plutonium in it. Same with Unit 2 and Unit 3. What made Unit 3 a little different was that Unit 3 had a little more plutonium because it had some test mixed oxide fuel bundles. But compared to the total amount of uranium in there and the total amount of plutonium, each of those reactors has huge inventory of plutonium. So we should worry about all three. Now, Monju has been canceled and delayed, and it ran for a couple months in the 90s. Monju is a breeder reactor, and the Japanese finally threw in the towel on it. But it's part of the myth in Japan. The Japanese believe that they can recycle every bit of uranium, so therefore they won't have to worry about building a waste dump for the spent nuclear fuel. On a seismic island, it's really hard to find a place that you can put something for a quarter of a million years. So they've created this myth that they can burn all of the plutonium from all the other reactors and essentially never have to get rid of the nuclear waste. So the Monju plant was part of that myth, and they canceled it, which is great because I think it was about 30 years delayed and about 10 years under construction. Anyway, billions of dollars were spent on that plant, and it was a total waste of money and time and energy.
Well, no doubt you've heard President Trump says he's going to advance America's nuclear arsenal, and it's been my long experience that nuclear power and nuclear weapons are deeply entwined. The history of nuclear power shows it was partly encouraged and heavily subsidized by successive presidencies. They wanted to maintain the expertise and a flow of nuclear material for bombs. Is that your understanding as well?
Yeah, you know, the first bomb that was dropped on Hiroshima was a uranium bomb. And it was made by enriching raw uranium in these huge enrichment plants in Tennessee. But the second bomb on Nagasaki was a plutonium bomb. And that was made from nuclear reactors in the United States at Hanford and then later down in South Carolina. We had nuclear reactors whose sole job was to produce plutonium for nuclear bombs, which is how the North Koreans have their nuclear bombs now. They have an operating reactor, they strip out the plutonium, and they make a weapon. It's also how the Indians and the Pakistanis made their bombs from, actually, they bought the reactors from Canada. The Canadian reactors make an enormous amount of plutonium. So they bought the reactors, signed the contract saying they wouldn't do what they did, and then they stripped the plutonium off to make bombs. So the reactors and bombs are inextricably intertwined.
Well, I realize this isn't your main area of nuclear expertise, but I bring this weapons thing up because as a nuclear engineer and as a really active citizen, I wonder what you think of this news. Russian media reports, complete with photographs, that they've developed a gigantic new missile. They say it can evade the American ballistic missile shield. This mega missile contains enough nuclear warheads, they say, to completely destroy an area the size of Texas. Arnie, what do you make of that?
There's two countries in the world that have the most nukes. It's the U.S. and Russia. If the Russians decided to shoot their old nukes at us, so many would get through the missile shield that we'd be toast anyway. So now if they've got a bigger one, we're still toast. You know, at the end of the day, if we go to war with Russia on nuclear weapons, we're toast. They are too, but but we are definitely toast. And I think, you know, Trump's rhetoric is amplifying this up. You know, just today, the clock people, the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists, advanced the clock to 2.5 minutes from midnight because basically Trump has terrified the world that we might have a nuclear weapon. Let's forget about the Russians with their huge arsenal and America with our huge arsenal. What concerns me are the small players, the Iranians and the North Koreans. North Koreans have perhaps a half a dozen to a dozen nukes and a few missiles. We did a piece on our site by a renowned engineer called Matt Stein. We looked at what would happen if a nuke was exploded in space. Now, forget blowing up a city. If you fire off a nuke 100 miles high, nothing gets destroyed on the planet. But an electromagnetic pulse comes down and knocks out everything. All your computers, all your transformers, everything. And it would devastate the East Coast of America for 10 to 20 years. And the estimates are 100 million people die because of, you know, lack of refrigeration, et cetera. So without destroying a single building, one nuke in space can take out all of the infrastructure that we rely on. You know, there's a couple of those actors out there. There's also the possibility of a small war between Pakistan and India. And small wars can escalate into bigger ones where both sides start to use nukes, which draw on superpowers. So I guess I view the conflict with Russia as, if it happens, we're toast, but both sides know that. But I'm more concerned about one of these small actors who really has nothing to lose, doing damage to our infrastructure and driving us to our knees.
Have you heard any rumors in the nuclear industry about whether Trump is reactor friendly or not?
Oh, that's a good question. I've heard both sides of it. I was interviewed on Project Censored a couple of weeks ago about that. You know, he claims to be a businessman, and building new nukes makes no economic sense. So if you're a real businessman, you're going to say, I don't want nukes. He also claims to be pro-coal, and pro-coal doesn't make any economic sense either, but if you're digging coal, you certainly don't need nuclear plants. And he also claims to be pro-American. Well, all of the nuclear power plants now are being made in China. We don't have the capability in America to build a nuclear power plant. So what happens is, you know, there's a couple plants being built down south in South Carolina and in Georgia. And in those cases, all the components are built in China, and large systems are pre-plumbed and put on a boat, and then they're just lifted up, put in place, and all the employees do is connect these blocks, Lego blocks, if you will. So all of the work is being done in China, in South Korea, and in Japan. So to think that we're creating American jobs because Westinghouse is on the side of the reactor, well, Westinghouse is owned by Toshiba, and they're in Japan. And General Electric is owned by Hitachi, and they're in Japan. So all this work is going offshore anyway. And then on the issue of energy independence, only about 20% of uranium that's in American nuclear power plants actually comes from America. You know, we get it from Canada. We get it from Australia. We get it from Russia. And a matter of fact, the American uranium mines are owned by Russian companies. So that you can't claim that we're energy independent because we've got nuclear plants, because all that uranium is coming from elsewhere too. So if he's a smart businessman, it makes no economic sense. On the other hand, a lot of his advisors are pro-nuclear. Rick Perry, for instance, who's going to be running the Department of Energy, has deep connections to people who would love to build a waste dump in Texas. The business community has his ear. And, you know, let's look at what the future is going to be. The nuclear industry says we need 1,000 large nukes between now and 2050. Well, that would cost $8 trillion to build 1,000 new nukes. We address this on the site. I'm going to pitch this site, fairwinds.org. But if you go to Smokescreen, we have a two-minute animation up there that talks about what a colossal waste of money building new nukes would be. You know, there's this thing called opportunity cost. Basically, if I spend money on one thing, I can't spend it on something else. Well, if we invest $8 trillion in 1,000 nukes, first off, it takes 35 years to build. And carbon dioxide is not going to take a break in the meantime. And secondly, if we had spent that $8 trillion on renewables, solar and wind, we would make a big dent right now in carbon dioxide. So if you believe in global warming, you wouldn't want to build nukes because the money is being misspent. And if you're a business person, you wouldn't build nukes because they don't make economic sense. And oh, by the way, one may blow up and take out the state of Illinois.
Well, nuclear reactors made in China, what could possibly go wrong? Now, Donald Trump says he will slash federal government regulations by 75%. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission is a mass pile of regulations. What if Trump slashes lots and lots of nuclear regulations without really looking into the ramifications? What then, Ernie?
Well, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission doesn't enforce its own regulations anyway. So I'm not sure we'd miss anything. You know, I lived on the same street with Bernie Sanders. Bernie's moved and I've moved since then. And I caught him one night and I said, Bernie, I want to be the next Nuclear Regulatory Commission commissioner, which is a political appointee. And he looked at me and he laughed and he says, Ernie, are you kidding? There's no way in hell they'd let you have that job. And I think that really speaks to it. The nuclear industry already controls the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. And by that, I mean that the five commissioners are all political appointees, and they're all vetted by NEI, which is Nuclear Energy Institute, which is the nuclear lobbying arm. So if we really think that we've got an independent regulator, that's a joke. Dave Lochbaum at Union of Concerned Scientists has said, if you want to shut down nuclear power, just enforce the regulations we have. We don't need tougher regulations. We just need to enforce the ones we have. Now, a fascinating story on that is that twice worker bee people within the NRC have come forward with major concerns. The first was Dr. Peck out in California, who had huge seismic concerns about Diablo Canyon. And the inspector general investigated him three times, because he expressed these concerns publicly. Every time he was exonerated. But, I mean, talk about the toll of having the NRC cops investigating you because you did the truth. Another guy is Larry, I think it's pronounced Criscione, but I'm not sure. He's up on our site, too, if you want to click through to the site. We have a testimonial to him. Well, Larry was identified that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission was covering up the fact that the Oconee plants, which are in the south, were in danger of being flooded if the upstream dam failed. Now, the NRC knew it, the owner of the plant knew it, and they didn't tell the public. So Larry wrote a letter to the commissioners, and he carboned Congress. Well, the inspector general came out and said, Larry, you have a choice. You can either quit or we'll throw you in jail. And Larry says, I'm not going to do either. He said, I'm going to stay. So they investigated him. And the Department of Justice says, this man's done nothing wrong. So dissent within the Nuclear Regulatory Commission isn't just frowned upon, it's prosecuted. And, you know, of course, Maggie and I have the story that Trump's at all, where we had, back in the 90s, we found safety violations. And the NRC went out of the way to destroy us and not resolve the safety violations. I ran into the guy who screwed me. This is John White, back in 2012, and Maggie confronted him with the report that said, you know, you deliberately misled the law and screwed Mr. Gunderson. And White looked her in the eye and he said, if I had it to do over again, I'd do the same thing. So that's the mentality at the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. It's a priesthood. They know, we don't. And as long as we don't argue with what the priests are saying, they're happy. But as soon as you disagree with the nuclear priesthood at the NRC and the industry, you're in the bullseye.
Boy, that's an attitude that is just cultivating the next big accident.
Radio EcoShock. Bright voices in dark times. Get more. EcoShock.info.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with nuclear engineer Arnie Gunderson from fairwinds.org. Arnie, we began by talking about the climate benefits versus regional risks of keeping old reactors running decades past their due date. This past year, New York Governor Cuomo said it was insane to keep the Indian Point reactor operating near New York City. Tell us about the risks there.
Yeah, the Indian Point reactors are 26 miles from Manhattan, and they're 1 mile from a fault that was undiscovered when they were built. And that fault would generate an earthquake worse than what they are designed to handle. So, you know, the question, if any of your readers or listeners are familiar with the Hudson River, basically it blocks flow east to west. So the reactors are on the east side, as are big towns. And if you tried to run, you can either go north or south, but you can't cross the river and run to the west because the river has very few bridges. So, and all of these are little country roads. Now, what the Nuclear Regulatory Commission did, assuming in their emergency planning, is that they assumed that when they gave the order to evacuate, only the people within 5 miles would leave, and therefore the roads wouldn't be crowded. Well, can you imagine if you get an order that if you're within 5 miles of a power plant and you've got to evacuate, do you think the people 10 miles are going to hang around? So they never looked at the congestion on the roads in the event of an accident. And, of course, you know, you've got people trying to escape from New York City, too. So the real issue at Indian Point was, first off, it's over 40 years old. And second off, it's near this seismic fault. And third, it's right outside of Manhattan. So I think Cuomo was right in insisting that it be shut down, because even back when I was in the industry in the 80s, everybody knew emergency planning at Indian Point was a joke.
And they reached some kind of deal to shut down Indian Point, but it sounds like a date with a lot of loopholes. What did they agree on?
Well, the state and the non-governmental organizations were using the existing law to say, look, if you want to keep this power plant running, you've got to build cooling towers, which is the correct interpretation. And the owner of the plant, Entergy, didn't want to spend $5 billion on cooling towers. And it looked like they were going to lose the legal argument. So they cut a deal. And they said, look, we'll cut it. We'll shut the plant down in 2021. But in the meantime, we're not going to build a cooling tower. So, you know, they get to make money for another 4 or 5 years. And hopefully there won't be a disaster in the meantime that's going to require the evacuation of Manhattan.
One of my personal worries is the overstock of nuclear waste right at reactor sites. You've done a lot of work on that. Is it just happening in America, or is it a problem all over the world?
Right now, only the Finns have a dump that's anywhere near ready to put nuclear waste in. And it's full for the few reactors they have right now. So if they wanted more reactors, they'd have to build another one. Nobody else in the world has a working nuclear dump. And this is high-level nuclear fuel, the stuff that's got to stay out of harm's way for a quarter of a million years. There's a great movie out on this. It's called Into Eternity. And it's agnostic. It just talks about the problems you face when you design something that has to be kept out of harm's way for a quarter of a million years. Now, a quick example is you put a sign on it saying, don't dig here, and realizing that 1,000 years from now, people's language is going to change. They won't be able to read it. In the States, the situation is no better than anywhere else. We have no dump available. Yucca Mountain was never scientifically the right place, but it was basically forced on the state of Nevada by all the other politicians in the country. When the bill went through, it was affectionately called the Screw Nevada Bill. And now, of course, under the regime change in Washington, it looks like they're going to try to revive Yucca Mountain over the dissent of the people of the state of Nevada. So we, just like the other states, don't have a effective dump. So you get to the question, though. Right now, we've got 100 dumps. You know, at 100 different nukes around the country, and they're all sitting out in the open as a terrorist target. The Europeans have the same problem, but they handle it differently. They have something called HOSS, H-O-S-S, hardened on-site storage, and they build a berm around the nuclear fuel, and they put a hardened roof over the outside, over the top, which prevents terrorists, and it also prevents airplanes from crashing into it. We don't do that in the States. So we've got 100 unprotected dumps around the country now. It looks like Rick Perry and the people at Department of Energy are going to try to move all of that waste to Texas. And it's one of these environmental justice things where the poor community in Texas has no idea what they're getting into, but they'll make some money in the meantime. So the waste will be shipped to Texas, where it will sit until there's a long-term place to put it. I'm against that because you've got thousands of train loads of nuclear waste that has to get shipped from Maine or from Vermont or from Washington State or from San Onofre. And it's not going to the final repository, so it has to get shipped twice. So the trade-off is the risk of shipping it twice worse than the risk of keeping it at the 100 nuclear reactors. And I am very afraid of the shipping risk.
Climate-aware nuclear fans like Dr. James Hansen promise next-generation nuclear reactors will be very safe and they will power maybe all of the world's needs. Arne Gundersen, what do you think?
Well, first off, Dr. Hansen is a brilliant guy and a courageous guy. In, I think, 88, he was the first person to tell Congress, look, the world is increasing in temperature and it's because of carbon dioxide. And if he had stopped there, it would have been great. And now he's got a chair at a university funded by a prominent nuclear sponsor. He talks about global warming, which he should, but he proposes that the solution is nuclear power. And again, I'll ask your viewers to watch this thing called Smokescreen, this two-minute animation. But building 1,000 new nukes, and he wants to build 2,500. 1,000 new nukes is a nuke every 12 days for the next 35 years. 2,500 is a nuke every 3 or 4 days for the next 35 years. And 1,000 new nukes is 8 trillion. Of course, his number would be 2.5 times that, or about $20 trillion. He doesn't look at where that money would be better spent. And that's the problem. You know, everybody can claim that the next generation nuclear is going to be better than the 70 years that went before. And, you know, there's always another gimmick in the nuclear industry. Oh, the next one's going to be cheaper, and on paper I can prove it. And then when it gets out into the field, it's not cheaper. So my problem with Dr. Hansen isn't his issues with global warming. It's that he doesn't look at the economics of his solution, which is to build 2,500 new nukes. And if he did, if you built 2,500 new nukes, you'd only put about a 20% dent in the carbon dioxide growth, but that dent would only begin to be important 35 years out when those nukes were running. So he doesn't look at this thing called opportunity cost, which is that we can build windmills, we can build solar farms in a year or two or three for a hell of a lot less money than $8 trillion and begin to reverse the carbon dioxide levels right now at a cost cheaper per kilowatt of electricity than his nuclear solution. So we have a solution on the table now. It's cheaper and faster. Why are we even considering the next generation nuclear? I don't know.
Tell us about Marco Kaltofen and his results at the Boston Chemical Data.
Dr. Kaltofen is a principal at Boston Chemical Data, and a lot of the samples that I got in Japan, he was able to analyze. And if you go up on his site, and I had the link, a funny link, you can get to see almost all the data, which the exciting part about what Dr. Kaltofen is doing is he's open sourcing the data that people are sending us from Japan. So if you go, your readers are going to have to take a pen out, but the site that has all of this data on it is littlegl.littlegl.com/ZTPM, little m, capital T.
They'll never make it. They'll never make it. But I tell you what, I will put that link in my EcoShock blog. So at EcoShock.org, the Wednesday after this show, that link will be there. Anybody can grab it and look for themselves.
So what we've been able to do, if people have sent us, we now have a complete set of workers' clothes, not from in the reactor, but the guys that are working on the piles of nuclear waste that are scattered throughout the prefecture. So we were able to get a complete set of workers' clothes. And frankly, we expected that the bottoms of their pants would be radioactive. And then, you know, as you work your way up, you get less radioactivity. We've got the gloves, we've got the shoes, we've got the pants, we've got the shirt. But the highest point of radioactivity on this guy's clothing was his zipper, which is truly frightening. You know, he's obviously not taking any kind of personal protection when he pulls down his fly. So now his pants are radioactive in the crotch. So that's just an example of the carelessness, the careless conditions the Japanese workers are working under.
Well, we'll get that link up at ecoshock.org. I wanted to ask you about any lawsuits that you've appeared in the last year or so, or is there something you're working on now?
We are working on one now, and by the time your show airs, I will be able to tell you what it is. So as soon as I can tell you, Alex, I'll send you an email about the testimony we're working on right now. It's a very important project, and but the attorneys have said that until the reports are published, I have to be quiet.
No worries. I'll put it in my blog as soon as I get it from you. So why don't you tell people a little bit more about what they can expect to find at fairwinds.org? Is it only for experts or for nuclear nerds or for all of us?
Oh, I think it's for all of us. You know, when I was a senior VP in the nuclear industry, and when I got blackballed from the nuclear industry, I became a school teacher. And I would work at night doing nuclear consulting, but my day job was school teaching. And I learned how to talk to high school seniors, juniors, and 10th graders and get the material in a form that a high school senior could understand or a high school 10th grader could understand. I'm not saying we dumb it down, because we don't, but we deliver the material in a format that people can understand. And I think that we are appreciated for doing that. It's a real data-intensive site, and we're in the process, once again, of trying to make it a little user-friendly, but it's got a great search function. So if you can't find it on the homepage and you know what you're looking for, you can hit the search function and find it.
Unfortunately, it looks like we're going into a dark place where government transparency will be dumped in favor of industry profits. I know climate scientists are duplicating some key databases offshore. It's possible people like you and I will be at best labeled fake news and at worst labeled terrorists. Do you think your struggle is about to get more difficult?
You know, Maggie and I have been in a dark place since 1990. You know, the nuclear industry has tried repeatedly to screw us. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission has refused to defend us. We lost our house. We went bankrupt. So if the world is coming into a dark place, I'll say welcome. I've already been there and remain there. You know, we had a DDoS attack, a distributed denial of service attack on our website, while I was working on the San Onofre steam generator project. You know, we could never find out who did it, but it knocked the site down for about 6 days. It cost us thousands of dollars to rebuild, and we never were able to rebuild our Japanese translation section. So, you know, we have been in the bullseye for years and years, and now other climate scientists, I guess, are going to learn that the government is not benign, and the only thing I can say is welcome to my world.
Do you have any parting words for our listeners, Arne Gundersen?
Well, I'd just love to thank everybody for watching the Fairwinds site. You know, we are reader-sponsored, so if anybody can spare some money, we'd sure appreciate it. We are in this for the long haul, and we really believe that nuclear is not the solution. In fact, it's the problem.
Our guest is Arne Gundersen, the nuclear engineer with experience in the industry who speaks out for greater nuclear safety. With wife Maggie, Arne can be found at the website fairwinds.org, and that's fair plus an E, winds.org. Think of the old English fair with an E at the end of it. And there you will find free online videos and nuclear information. Arne, as always, I thank you so much for providing the clarity on Radio EcoShock.
Well, thanks, Alex. I really appreciate, you know, this long-standing conversation you and I have been having.
We'll keep it up as long as we can. I'm Alex Smith.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Electronic Intifada's weekly Palestine podcast.
Attorneys are trying to invoke all parts of the Constitution that could possibly protect people, the most vulnerable people, refugees and immigrants, from these kinds of executive orders. So they're not only protecting them against discrimination, but just things like due process, which applies to everyone on U.S. soil.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
The Electronic Intifada.
This is the Electronic Intifada podcast.
Today, San Francisco!
Today, San Francisco!
Showed up!
Showed up!
For the last 6 hours!
For the last 6 hours!
We stood firm!
We stood firm!
In defiance!
In defiance!
And in defense!
And in defense!
To make sure!
To make sure!
That every family!
That every family!
Was released!
Was released!
Oakland, I'm Nora Barrows Friedman. You're listening to the Electronic Intifada podcast, and I'm here with our associate editor, Charlotte Silver, staff reporter who has been following the news coming out of the new Trump administration and how it applies to immigrants and refugees coming in from Muslim majority countries, the so-called Muslim ban. Charlotte, you and I were both at protests here in the San Francisco Bay Area over this past weekend at San Francisco International Airport. Can you talk a little bit about what you saw there and, you know, your reaction to what's been happening with these executive orders from the Trump administration so far?
Well, what I saw at the protests at SFO was an organized and focused crowd of protesters with very specific demands. They came to SFO because people with valid visas or green cards in some cases were being detained at the border. Some were being transferred to county jails throughout the weekend. So people were going to the airports to respond and protest to the immediate implementation of Trump's executive order, the Muslim, you know, so which we know as the Muslim ban, because it halts entry and directs the potential deportation of people with valid visas, with legal authorization to be in the U.S., but because they are nationals of seven countries, those documents are no longer valid. What I saw was a protest very focused, responding to what appeared to be a very chaotic implementation of the executive order. And on Saturday night, when people were rallying at SFO, the first court order issuing a nationwide stay, a partial stay on the executive order, was announced, which kind of added more chaos to the mix because it was unclear how that court order was going to be complied with by federal agents with the Customs Border Protection. But I also want to make really clear that I think that we should be cautious in just describing the rollout of the executive order and the response to the court orders as chaotic, because it kind of gives them too much credit. With that, their evidence that they have failed to comply with court orders and evidence that they've continued to detain, in one case deport, people who have valid authorization to enter the U.S., direct violation of the court order, that this wasn't intentional. And there's been several reports from around the country, from their airport in D.C., Southern California, where Custom Border Protection agents are telling lawyers, telling Congress people, telling activists that they are specifically not complying with the court order, that is not applying to them. So there are serious reasons to be concerned about the Trump administration and its federal agencies' willingness to comply to court orders.
And Charlotte, you've been tracking this very carefully the past few days. Yesterday, on Wednesday, you published a story. Are U.S. Marshals refusing to enforce court orders against Trump's Muslim ban? Tell us a little bit more detail about this interaction between Customs and Border Protection and lawyers who are trying to get them to enforce the stay against this executive order, what that means for people, and you know, any news, any updates that you've got today on Thursday.
Yeah. So the court orders from New York and Boston, which were nationwide, which were to apply nationwide and were to halt any deportation or detention of people with valid authorization to enter the U.S., even if they are from the seven countries targeted by Trump's EO executive order. In those court orders, the judge instructs U.S. marshals to take any steps necessary to make sure the orders are complied with. The U.S. marshals are the sort of enforcement arm of the Judiciary Act. So when this happened, it's very rare that so U.S. marshals only need to be invoked and be called upon if there's evidence that people are not in compliance. So when the CBP, Custom Border Protection in LA, actually deported at least one person, maybe more, and here's the big problem, there's no transparency. CBP has refused to release any data on who they've detained or deported. So when the federal agents in LA deported someone, it gave serious concern that they were not in compliance with the court order. Another emergency session was called, and another Southern California judge instructed CBP to allow that person that they deported to come back and enter the U.S. This man had already traveled, was already in Dubai by the time that that court order came down. So kind of on their own, immigration attorneys went to the U.S. marshals and brought them the court order so that they would actually be serving them the papers so that to try to trigger U.S. marshals action so that they would to start enforcing the court order. And, you know, as you can read in the report, the immigration attorneys were sort of deferred to different people, and U.S. Marshals first told them to go to the U.S. Attorney's Office. Then they told them to go to the Department of Justice. U.S. Marshals did not know how to act. The U.S. Marshals told me, a spokesperson for the U.S. Marshals told me that they were dependent on further instructions from the judge. So this means that after the court order was issued, in order for the U.S. Marshals to act, they need to be instructed more specifically from the judge who determines whether or not federal agents are not complying. So the U.S. Marshals can't on their own determine whether or not Customs Border Protection, for example, are not in compliance. They have to wait for the judges to tell them that they're not in compliance and then tell the U.S. Marshals what to do. So that's according to the U.S. Marshals Service. So there have been several status hearings to review whether or not Customs Border Protection, Department of Homeland Security are in compliance with the court orders. And in Virginia, the Attorney General has actually joined the case against Trump and all of these federal agencies, joined against them and alleged that Trump and DHS are in contempt of court by not abiding by court orders. So this is sort of, we're now going down the road of potentially the judge instructing U.S. marshals to act to enforce. And so that would be the case in which U.S. marshals would be enforcing the court orders on CBP at airports.
And as you pointed out in your article, there's no precedent for these kinds of moves by both of these agencies.
Exactly. Like in the past, the president has, you know, called upon U.S. marshals to enforce court orders. It's not usually the judge who's having to call on U.S. marshals to enforce it against the executive branch.
Charlotte, let's talk a little bit about another story, actually, that we published on the Electronic Intifada. Michael Brown wrote a report about Stephen Miller, who's Trump's senior advisor, and his 1 degree of separation away from Richard Spencer, of course, the white supremacist who has been whipping up a frenzy of racists and white nationalists across the country. And Miller's central role, he wrote, in authoring the executive order banning entry to nationals of 7 countries, the Muslim ban. You know, in talking with these immigration attorneys and spokespersons for the U.S. government, has there been any discussions about this overall atmosphere of these power grabs by white nationalists and the behind the scenes maneuvering of extreme anti-immigrant, anti-refugee, Islamophobic rhetoric being hurled at people on their way here?
Right. Well, I think right now attorneys are trying to invoke all parts of the Constitution that could possibly protect people, the most vulnerable people, refugees and immigrants, from these kinds of executive orders. So, you know, they're not only protecting them against discrimination, but just things like due process, which applies to everyone, on U.S. soil, including at the border. And so I think that the Trump administration has clearly tried to sell and present his executive order as a means for increasing national security, which I don't think anyone is buying. And thankfully, if anyone is buying it, you only need to look at the very specific statements issued by people like Giuliani, who has said that the executive order was written with the very intent of excluding Muslims, but done so in a way that didn't actually identify, you know, the religious demographic of who was being excluded, so that in an attempt to make it survive any court challenges. But, you know, it's still very weak.
Well, finally, Charlotte, just to kind of tie it back to the Israel factor, you also published a story this morning on Thursday about a group of U.S. citizens and Palestinian nationals suing not only Israel's Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, but key members of Donald Trump's administration for perpetrating and enabling war crimes. Can you talk a little bit about this lawsuit and really how it ties in to what we're seeing playing out in airports all across the country and the extreme Islamophobic and anti-Arab rhetoric by the Trump administration?
Well, so this lawsuit, it's filed by the same man who's filed 3 other lawsuits against various elements on this financial cycle that sends charitable donations to settlements and settlers in the West Bank. And this latest lawsuit is identifying key Israeli political leaders, Netanyahu and Avigdor Lieberman and Ehud Barak, and also the Kushner Family Foundation, which is Jared Kushner's family foundation. Jared Kushner is Trump's son-in-law, and he's also been appointed as a White House advisor on the Middle East. It also names David Friedman, who is Trump's pick as the new U.S. ambassador to Israel. Kushner's foundation and Friedman have sent millions of dollars. I think the total combined is $2 billion a year to efforts to fund settlement expansion, including some of the most violent extreme settlers in the West Bank who inflict daily violence on Palestinians. So this lawsuit is invoking U.S. tax law and also anti-terrorism law, because it's claiming that the settlers that are receiving these tax-deductible donations are actually committing international terrorism. And so, you know, this is sort of a twist to our civil laws against terrorism that allows there to be civil claims against people who are alleged to provide material support to terrorists, which has historically only been used against Arab and Muslim groups. So we've seen a lot of persecution of Palestinians accused of supporting Hamas and other Palestinian charities like the Holy Land Foundation. They have come under under attack through this Anti-Terrorism Act. Lately, there has been some attempt for Palestinians to use this this very problematic act, to file suit against those funding Israeli settlers. And what's interesting about these lawsuits is that it requires the litigants to argue that the settlement activity is distinct from the Israeli state. So specifically in this latest lawsuit, the Martin McMahon, the lawyer, argues that Netanyahu and Lieberman and Ehud Barak in funding settlers are actually fulfilling their own personal agenda. And they have to do this because there are laws that protect sovereign nations from civil litigation. And this is, they've repeatedly protected Israeli leaders, and the law basically says that if someone is acting as part of a state policy, then they can't be held, they can't be sued and responsible for damages in U.S. courts. We have the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. And so that, you know, what this has meant in terms of the Israel-Palestine issue is that Palestinians are vulnerable because they aren't considered a sovereign nation and Israeli leaders are protected. Last year, a law was passed called the Justice for State Terrorism Act or something like that. JASTA is the acronym. And it allows, and it was specifically passed with the idea of allowing U.S. victims of 9/11 to sue Saudi Arabia, because Saudi Arabia has also long been shielded from the Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act. So this law passed, and now the lawsuit against Saudi Arabia is going forward. It was this law was vehemently opposed by Obama, who actually vetoed it. But then Congress overrode his veto for the first and only time during his 8-year presidency. So this was a very political act, you know, with a lot of support from constituents and because of 9/11 and the desire to allow people to sue Saudi Arabia as responsible for the 9/11 attacks. So this latest lawsuit invokes JASTA to try and weaken the sovereignty that Netanyahu may claim, but ultimately it's not relying on JASTA. It's relying more on portraying Israeli settler activity as independent from Israeli policy, which if you read Electronic Intifada, you know, does not adhere very closely to the truth, since Israeli state policy is very clearly set up to colonize Palestinian land.
And just in the past week, of course, the Israeli government announced its intention to build thousands of new settlement units in the occupied West Bank.
Exactly.
All right. Well, we're going to keep watching these stories, of course, very, very carefully. Charlotte Silver, thank you so much for all of your work this week and every week on the Electronic Intifada. And you can read her work on electronicintifada.net. Charlotte Silver, thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Laura.
And that's it for the Electronic Intifada podcast. For news, information, cultural features and reviews, and pointed opinion and analysis, visit us online at electronicintifada.net, where you can also post comments and sign up for our daily email digest. Follow us on Twitter at Intifada. Radio stations are free to use this podcast, and if you're listening on iTunes, support the Electronic Intifada podcast by rating it and leaving a review. On behalf of all of us at the Electronic Intifada, thank you for listening.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next, Between the Lines.
Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. This week we present Pardis Cabrai of the Center for Constitutional Rights, who examines the constitutional arguments against President Trump's executive order, halting immigration from seven majority Muslim nations. Nadia Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink Women for Peace, who assesses the future of the growing Trump resistance movement and the Democratic Party's response to mass mobilization. And Mark Maurer, executive director of the Sentencing Project, who explains why he believes the Trump administration will be an obstacle to progress on federal criminal justice reform. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
On his first full day in the White House, President Donald Trump reimposed the global gag rule, which bans aid to international groups that provide abortions or abortion advocacy. Trump expanded the ban beyond family planning funding to include all global health assistance, such as HIV/AIDS and Zika funding. Currently, the United States is the most generous donor nation for reproductive health, with $575 million in aid. The Guardian newspaper reports global health campaigners are alarmed at the impact of the new gag rule that could put $9 billion in global health aid at risk. Susan Ehlers of the reproductive rights group Population Action International, or PAI, called the new Trump executive order irrational and backward. The global gag rule, sometimes called the Mexico City policy, was initiated by President Reagan in 1984 to bar U.S. funding for family planning from international aid groups if they provided information about abortions, referrals, or services. But the Trump order goes much further to include HIV/AIDS, malaria, maternal health, and child health care. PAI's Ehler insisted this is not pro-choice policy. This is a policy denying women life-saving services. It will, for example, cut off funding for groups providing HIV test kits for teenagers. The government of the Netherlands pledged to replace the lost U.S. family planning funding by creating a multinational safe abortions fund. On January 1st, Rex Tillerson resigned as CEO of ExxonMobil after working for 40 years for the oil giant in order to accept President Trump's nomination for Secretary of State. As Tillerson was testifying on Capitol Hill, a few blocks away, ExxonMobil was preparing for a federal civil trial on charges the oil company participated in human rights abuses, including murder and torture in the autonomous region of Aceh, Indonesia. The case, John Doe versus ExxonMobil, deals with complaints of abuses committed by security forces hired to protect Exxon's natural gas operations in Indonesia from 2000 to 2004. The case charges that ExxonMobil effectively privatized Indonesian army soldiers, despite the long history of those forces engaging in gross human rights abuses. Under Tillerson, ExxonMobil has fought the case for 15 years, denying not that human rights abuses took place, but rather that the company should not be liable. A federal judge rejected ExxonMobil's argument, saying the oil conglomerate's top executives exerted significant control over the security decisions made by Exxon's Indonesia affiliate. According to the news magazine In These Times, this is one in a series of human rights lawsuits against ExxonMobil under Tillerson's leadership. Other lawsuits involved human rights abuses, unsafe working conditions, investor and public fraud, destruction of the environment, climate change, and support of dictators. 5 years ago, Muslim American residents of Basking Ridge in central New Jersey sought a building permit to construct a mosque. Local zoning officials objected, saying there wasn't enough parking at the facility and it would create traffic problems. There were also a series of hostile acts, including vandalism targeting the Basking Ridge Islamic Society. After years of hearings and delays, the permit for the mosque was rejected. The decision forced local Muslims to rent out space in a community center to conduct Friday prayers. The Obama administration's Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department filed a lawsuit against the township, charging the intent of its action was to discriminate against Muslims, which violated the 2000 Religious Land Use and Institutionalized Persons Act. The number of federal discrimination cases involving Muslims has skyrocketed since 2010, driven by high-profile opposition to new mosques, such as Park 51 in Lower Manhattan, only blocks from the former World Trade Center destroyed in the 9/11 terrorist attack. On January 27th, Holocaust Remembrance Day, President Trump signed an executive order banning the entry of immigrants and refugees from 7 majority Muslim nations. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
The first week of Donald Trump's presidency has seen a succession of controversial changes to U.S. policy that have triggered protests across the nation. However, Trump's January 27th executive order, titled Protection of the Nation from Foreign Terrorist Entry into the U.S., provoked tens of thousands of people to demonstrate their opposition at airports from coast to coast. The executive order suspended entry of all refugees to the United States for 120 days, and bans travel from 7 Muslim-majority nations for 90 days, including Iraq, Syria, Iran, Sudan, Libya, Somalia, and Yemen. The order also blocks all refugees from Syria indefinitely and reduces the total number of refugees admitted into the U.S. during the 2017 fiscal year to 50,000, down from the previous number of 110,000. In response to Trump's executive order, the ACLU and other activist groups filed class action lawsuits challenging the president's order. Quickly, 4 federal judges issued stays, temporarily blocking enforcement of immigration restrictions. While the Trump administration denies that the order singles out Muslims, the executive action includes preferential treatment for Christians. Civil liberties attorneys have challenged Trump's executive order based on the fact that discrimination against refugees on the basis of religion is unconstitutional. Acting U.S. Attorney General Sally Yates, who had served as Deputy Attorney General under President Obama, refused to defend the order and was summarily fired by President Trump. Heads of state across the globe, Christian leaders, Democratic lawmakers, and 15 state attorney generals have all condemned Mr. Trump's immigration restrictions. Your reporter spoke with Center for Constitutional Rights Senior Staff Attorney Pardis Ghebrei, who examines the constitutionality of Trump's executive order, halting immigration from majority Muslim nations.
It is discriminatory. It's discriminatory by virtue of the fact that it singles out these Muslim-majority countries. This discriminatory aspect of this order is completely clear when you look at things like this carve-out it has for refugee admissions, where if you are a religious minority in a country alleging or saying that you are facing religious persecution, that may make you eligible for admission, but otherwise you would not be. So, for example, an Iraqi Christian who is facing persecution, religious persecution by virtue of their Christian faith in Iraq or Syria by ISIS, would be entitled to be considered for admission to the United States, whereas an Iraqi Muslim who is fleeing violence and war and, you know, physical harm in that way would be barred from admission. So, you know, that's what the order does. It's extremely broad. It also introduces broad new vetting procedures for anyone, any traveler to the United States. It ties one's beliefs, one's ideology to criteria that could be considered for admission. It's unclear exactly how beliefs and sort of ideology would be implemented in terms of new vetting procedures and, you know, what that would actually look like. But it asserts that as broadly as a criteria that can be considered. So it's really broad. I think, you know, when we woke up Saturday morning and heard reports, it changed things overnight, obviously, with the stroke of a pen. I mean, it was signed Friday night. Saturday morning, we woke to reports of people being pulled off planes abroad, families being separated at airports, hundreds of people being detained. By the end of Saturday, there was a federal court order staying parts of the order for people who were in transit at the time the order was signed and were being detained at airports in the United States. being told that they couldn't enter. The order was stayed with respect to some of those people, and there were massive protests. I mean, the response was overwhelming. And so I think for our feeling anyway, and my colleagues quickly went from kind of shock and just being appalled in the morning to real hopefulness at seeing just the massive public response, people turning out and saying, this is not who we are. This is not humane.
Well, Pardis, what is the strength of the argument, the constitutional argument, against the Trump administration executive order here on the suspension of immigration from these seven nations? I've heard that this could go all the way to the Supreme Court, but how much power does a president have to contravene laws on the books that prohibits discrimination based on nation of origin or religion?
Well, there is wide discretion, executive discretion and congressional discretion when it comes to the nation's borders and when it comes to immigration control. That said, no one is above the Constitution. No one is above the law. I think when you read this order, it is clearly discriminatory in its impact. It may talk about specific countries. These are Muslim majority countries. The impact, the overwhelming impact of this order is addressed to one specific faith of people. Many of those people are U.S. lawful residents with constitutional rights, and those rights must be respected. So the president has a lot of power when it comes to immigration, but no more power than the Constitution gives him. So I think, yeah, there have already, I mean, on day one, there were challenges filed in court, temporary stays issued by federal judges. Those cases are going to continue. And there are new lawsuits being developed now that we're going to see in the coming days. There's a response, you know, legally. There's also responses politically by Congress. There are bills being introduced or talked about being introduced, calling for the president to take back this order, to revoke this order. So we could see sort of its end, and we should see its end in response to pressure from different directions. But at least as to its unconstitutionality by the courts, I think, you know, already we've seen signs that federal judges view this order as violating the Constitution, at least in certain respects. And that's why these stays have been issued. I mean, they're temporary stays, but they are because judges have found that there is merit to the arguments that are being put forward. So, you know, while these are interim stays and there has to be further argument and decision, you know, on the merits fully, the initial reading of judges anyway of the arguments that have been put forward is that they have merit.
That was Center for Constitutional Rights Senior Staff Attorney Pardis Kabrai. Learn more about the constitutional arguments against Trump's executive order restricting immigration by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. From the very first day of the Trump presidency, massive numbers of protesters took to the streets to declare unyielding opposition to the real estate billionaire's extreme right-wing agenda. The historic Women's March on Washington, and hundreds of other cities across the U.S. and abroad, was the largest political protest in modern American history, challenging Trump's positions on a wide array of issues, as well as his cabinet nominees. In his first week in office, Trump signed more than a dozen executive orders, reversing many Obama administration-era policies. The orders, taken from a laundry list of Trump campaign pledges, aimed to revive the previously blocked Keystone XL and Dakota Access pipelines, defund sanctuary cities that protect undocumented immigrants from federal deportation, and what essentially is a temporary ban on Muslim refugees and immigrants entering the U.S. At the same time, many career civil servants who had served both Democratic and Republican presidents were forced out of their jobs in what some observers labeled a purge of personnel at government agencies deemed insufficiently loyal to Trump's agenda. Frightening to many was the president's recent promotion of his chief strategist, Steve Bannon, a white nationalist, to a permanent seat on the National Security Council, while demoting the Pentagon's chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and the director of National Intelligence. Your reporter spoke with Medea Benjamin, co-founder of the women-led peace group Code Pink, author and lifelong activist and organizer. Here, Benjamin assesses the future of the growing Trump resistance movement
and the Democratic Party's response to the mass mobilization.
Scott, I think the Women's March was just magnificent. There were hundreds of them around the country. And let's also remember they were happening in other countries as well, which is a great show of solidarity. And then every day of the executive orders that Trump was putting out, I'm here in Washington, and there would be these spontaneous gatherings outside the White House, sizes that we have not seen before since the height of the Iraq war protests, or maybe some of the very big environmental rallies. But, you know, during these Obama years, it's been hard to get people out to things. And now, boy, you just put something out on Facebook and you got thousands of people. I just came back from the steps of the Supreme Court where the Democrats came out to speak about the Muslim ban. And it was packed with people. I mean, you could barely find a place to stand. My point is to say that every single day in D.C., and then, of course, we can talk about the airport protests that have been just unbelievably beautiful. So this country is erupting with resistance.
And Medea, I've been reading some concern from people looking at this explosion of activism in the streets all across the country, totaling more than 4 million over this just first week of the Trump administration. Is there a danger of resistance fatigue, that this passion will die out if it's tapped into, you know, every 12 hours there's something new to protest, which I'm sure the Trump folks have a stack of both executive orders and legislation ready to go?
Certainly there is already some resistance fatigue, and there will be a lot more of it if we have to keep going at this pace. And as you said, this is something that the Trump folks are counting on. On the other hand, I think as the weather gets nicer, we're going to see a new outbreak of Occupy-type resistance at the local level, focuses on sit-ins or takeovers of congressional offices, Senate offices. I think we're going to see big protests again around pipelines and other environmental issues. I think what's going to happen is it's not going to be D.C. focused. There will be some, like already there's a big march planned for April 29th, 100 days of the Trump administration. But we're going to see some radical stuff going on locally. And I think the airport protests are just a prelude to that.
I wanted to ask you about the Democrats. What's your analysis of how the Democratic Party has responded to the Trump agenda coming out so fast and furious here with all these very dramatic and extremist policy positions and executive orders? We've seen some U.S. senators, Democrats, voting for some of these very questionable cabinet nominees, and a lot of disappointment among activists. Do you see Democrats acting as a united front here in opposing many of these Trump agenda items? Or do they need a lot more pressure from the street to get them right with the sentiment out there of certainly what looks to be a majority of people around the country?
There's the issue of opposing Trump's nominees, and it is shameful that any Democrat would vote for any of these nominees because they're all so bad. And then there's the issue of what are the Democrats themselves going to do to clean up their house so that they become a vibrant party. And there's big divisions within the party itself. And I think we will see if Keith Ellison is able to become the chair of the DNC, the Democratic National Committee, then I think we're going to see a real fighting party. If he doesn't, it's going to be business as usual. I was heartened to see the senators and congresspeople out on the steps of the Supreme Court today, but they should be leading the marches in their home communities when they go back home. They should be at the airports without people having to demand that they get out there and show up because of public pressure. They should be there because it's the right thing to do and what a leader does. You've seen a brand new congressperson, Pramila Jayapal from Seattle, who has been on the front lines of demonstrations, of speaking out, educating her constituency. And she is a brand new congresswoman. And you think, my goodness, you know, she is setting an example for so many of these congresspeople who have been in power for many, many years. Some of us would say too many years.
That was Medea Benjamin, co-founder of Code Pink Women for Peace, author and lifelong activist and organizer. Learn more about the many groups and coalitions organizing in opposition to the Trump agenda by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Criminal justice issues have so far taken a back seat to the Trump administration's early executive orders restricting the entry of immigrants and refugees, building the Mexican border wall, and the president's nomination of conservative Judge Neil Gorsuch to the U.S. Supreme Court. But starting with the fact that candidate Trump supported the death penalty and torture and called himself the law and order candidate, those working to reform the U.S. criminal justice system and reduce the prison and jail population of 2.2 million, are very concerned. Their worry is focused on what issues may be addressed in future executive orders or new legislation from the Republican-controlled Congress. Mark Maurer is executive director of the Sentencing Project, a group which researches alternatives to the nation's prison industrial complex. He notes that in 1970, the U.S. held 300,000 prisoners, but that number grew in 2016 to 2.2 million, a sevenfold increase. In recent years, the number of inmates has declined slightly as a result of changes at the federal level and in some states. But despite the reductions, the U.S. still holds more prisoners than any other country in the world. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Mark Maurer, who lays out some of the likely changes in direction on criminal justice policies carried out under the Obama administration these past 8 years.
We don't really know yet what the criminal justice agenda is going to look like. You know, on the one hand, we've had several years of building bipartisan support in Congress for sentencing reform. Senator Grassley, who chairs the Judiciary Committee, longtime Republican conservative, had been a leading sponsor and proud to be sponsoring a sentencing reform bill, and we saw related bills in the House. The new president, though, to the extent he has any history on these issues, he announced on the campaign trail that he's the law and order candidate. He's made some fairly vicious statements in the past, advocating for a death penalty and other harsh punishments. So we don't know how that conflict will be resolved or so. The other issue, of course, is the next Attorney General, Senator Sessions, having been nominated. Senator Sessions, in addition to all his beliefs and policies regarding immigration, other issues on criminal justice policy, he's been very much a tough on crime advocate for a long time. He was an opponent of the sentencing reform legislation in Congress. When it passed through the Judiciary Committee on a bipartisan vote, he was one of a number of Republicans who voted against it. He hasn't said much about what his priorities will be, but, you know, we're not terribly optimistic at that level either. The Civil Rights Division of the Justice Department has been very aggressive and responding broadly to the tensions between law enforcement and African-American communities, developed consent decrees, and been engaged in Ferguson, Baltimore, Chicago, and many other cities. Senator Sessions has made it pretty clear he's not very interested in pursuing that line of action and essentially is, you know, a law enforcement supporter and doesn't seem like he's terribly interested in dealing with tensions in any other kinds of ways right now.
Mark Maurer, I've been hearing mention of Trump's support for private prisons. This with the backdrop of the federal government announcing last year that it is moving away from private prisons. What can you say about that move and about Trump's plans, if any, in this regard?
The federal government has been a major contractor with private prisons, but as a result of a very critical report by the Inspector General of the Justice Department regarding what happens in private prisons, and also the fact that the federal prison population has been declining. There's less need for them to contract out for those beds. Following that announcement, the stock of the major private prison companies went down 35% the next day. Then the day after the election in November, the stock of the private prison companies went up 40%. Numerous studies have documented higher levels of abuse, poor training of staff, high turnover, poor management, not to mention that they generally don't save any significant amount of money either. Now, having said that, that doesn't suggest that public prisons, whether they're federal or state, are necessarily doing a good job or avoiding those issues. Now, we haven't heard specific policy recommendations from Senator Sessions or the White House so far, but everything in the past suggests that they would be much more favorably inclined to look towards private prison operators, just part of their general belief in the private sector. So this is a very troubling development. You know, unless they have plans to dramatically increase the federal prison population, it's really uncalled for, because with the population declining, they can handle what number of people they have in prison through the regular federal prisons. So it's partly a question of ideology versus practicality and money and how they come out on all those issues.
So give me a temperature check on the issue of criminal justice reform as you see it right now.
You know, nearly 90% of the people behind bars are at the state or local level. So there's some reason for hope there. You know, a good number of states have enacted policy reforms in recent years, specifically for lower-level drug offenses, also around community supervision and how people are reentering the community. And most of those states are relatively pleased with the results that they've seen so far. So I think there's a pretty big gap between what goes on in Washington and what happens at the state level. So regardless of the rhetoric or policy at the federal level, I think there's good reason to believe that much of that reform momentum at the state level can continue in the next several years.
That was Mark Maurer, executive director of the Washington, D.C.-based Sentencing Project. Learn more about the criminal justice reform work of the project by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our region, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in MP3 and streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Twitter at BTL Radio News. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and Jody Gray and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Gary Trujillo, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.
Listening to Radio Free Radical.
Coming up next.
Mumia Abu-Jamal's radio essay.
The real Eddie Africa. For most people, if you mention the words MOVE organization, it elicits profoundly negative connotations driven principally by negative coverage by the corporate media. In fact, most people have never met a MOVE person, and whatever opinion they possess is based on media projections, not real knowledge. Today, you'll hear a MOVE member, Eddie Africa, a survivor of the MOVE confrontation of August 8, 1978, when police attacked the MOVE house at 33rd and Powelton, West Philadelphia. Eddie was one of nine MOVE members arrested there and sentenced to an unjust 30 to 100-year sentence in connection with the death of a cop who was part of the invasion force that attacked the house. For over the last decade, Eddie has counseled young prisoners, both formally and informally, in how to avoid the trap of prison, especially children in prison.
Oh, that's good, because this is one of the points I was trying to make. Children his age are just starting to step out on their own or think for themselves. But a lot of them are doing it without any kind of advice or guidance from their father, because their father's in here. Too many of them, their fathers are in here.
Eddie looks at some of the young prisoners who adopt bad ideas.
And a lot of these guys, when they come in here, they put the idea of their children to the side. And they tell themselves, I'm going to wait till I get out. But we're trying to stop that.
Eddie is a warm, funny, compassionate man who at nearly 70 years of age is a magnet for young men who need guidance along the right path. Eddie explains to young fathers how to be with their kids.
Use this time to be with them, you know, talking to them, writing them. Hopefully, it will help teach some of these young guys so they don't go the path that their parents went. I'll be watching the news, and my last four or five cell partners were all young people who were in gangs. So I'm getting plenty of opportunity to speak with them and hopefully to discourage them from that, so that they'll think about doing something a little more positive than being in a gang or running around and acting crazy. But it's just a matter of you give them respect, and then you can demand it. You know what I mean? A lot of the older guys, they don't want to talk to the younger guys, and that's a mistake.
For 38 years, Eddie Africa has been in prison, and such time could have made him a bitter, nasty man. In this, it has failed. He has been a resource to help young men center themselves on their families, on their children, on the future, not the past. That's the real Eddie Africa of the MOVE organization. From Imprison Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
President Obama reassured the nation that everything was all right after the ascension of Donald Trump to the Oval Office. Well, a week has passed, and guess what? It ain't all right. Perhaps for the Obamas it's all right, for they go on to lives as a wealthy, privileged family. Not so for millions of Americans who are Muslims, not to mention millions of Muslims living overseas. For them, the realization that the U.S. has announced what can only be termed a Muslim ban fills the pits of their stomachs with dread. Trump, the president of paranoia, who campaigned on fear of the other, xenophobia, misogyny, and a crude racism. The world is out to get him. Him, who was born to wealth and all its advantages. The ban of Muslim immigrants has been the best recruiting poster Al-Qaeda or ISIS could ever have dreamed of. According to some reports, ISIS prayed for Trump's victory. Well, their prayers have been answered. 1 week, and the nation is awash in chaos. Yeah, buddy, a hell of a job of making America great again. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
You're listening to Radio Free Radical, your online antidote to corporate media crap.
all right. Welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and I have been preparing for this show since 4:30 this morning. So if I start to sound crazy, that's why, okay? I'm not usually up. I'm usually going to bed at 4:30 in the morning, not getting up, okay? Anyway, this show is a packed show, and it deserves to be. It needs to be. At the back end of the show, we'll be talking with Ahilan Arulanantham, Director of Advocacy and Legal Director at the ACLU of Southern California and a former senior staff attorney at the ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project. And we're going to be talking about Trump's attack on immigrants. Before that, we'll be talking with Andy Z, spokesperson for Revolution Books New York City and one of the initiators of Refuse Fascism, on the consolidation of the Trump-Pence regime and what that means for humanity and whether people can still drive it out and what people need to do. And opening the show up, I'm going to read you something here, all right? And this has to do with what Trump just did in relation to what they call the Mexico City policy, okay? Trump, or we shall, why don't we just call him the Fuhrer? The Fuhrer has reinstituted a ban on providing federal money to international groups that perform abortions or provide information about abortions. The regulation known as the Mexico City policy, or by critics as the global gag rule, has been a political volleyball instituted by Republican administrations and rescinded by Democratic ones since 1984. Trump signed an executive action to reinstate a ban one day after the 44th anniversary of the Supreme Court's 1973 Roe v. Wade decision that legalized abortion in the United States. And it's the date on which presidents traditionally take action on the policy. And it also prohibits taxpayer funding for groups that lobby to legalize abortion or to promote it as family planning method. With this action, the Fuhrer has turned his anti-woman rhetoric into policy and made it more difficult for women and families all over the world to access vital reproductive care. So says NARAL President Elisa Hoog. And she adds, he is really living up to the lowest of expectations. Now, I wanted to have someone who I really respect come on the show and speak to some of this, what's going on around abortion rights and the assault on women, and in particular in the wake of this recent development with the Mexico City, with the Mexico City policy. And I thought, and it took me about a minute to realize who it was I actually wanted, and I really wanted. So he's always in my mind when I start to think about doing a program on abortion and abortion rights and the importance of that being available to women. And that's Dr. Lee Carhart. And Lee is a doctor performing late-term abortions. And he's going to be talking with us about the Trump regime's opening attack on abortion rights and what the fascist president has promised to do, end all abortions for all women. Lee, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael, for having me back.
Yeah, it's great to have you back. We have to have you back a lot more, man, okay? That's what we'll do. Well, let's jump into this. I don't know how much you know or how well-versed you are in what's going on with Trump's assault, one, around Mexico City, but how do you see this in terms of, one, your thoughts on that kind of ban that's going on, this kind of ban of money to be used for any purpose, abortion aid, or even, you know, there's a number of things that actually are prevented as well that are necessary for women's health that are prevented as well in relation to this. What's your thoughts on that?
You know, we're talking about worldwide right now, and if we're not talking about the United States, but, you know, unintended pregnancies and actually the strive for women to maintain their control of fertility is probably one of the leading causes of death in most of the third world countries. I think the estimates are 375 women a day right now in third world countries die from self-attempted or illegal abortions. Or actually, they're not even illegal. They're just done by people that have no idea about medical basis. And to restrict, you know, we were just making great inroads. And it's not only abortion, of course. This also bans people that discuss contraception. So it just opens the women of foreign countries back up to being in a totally controlled environment.
One of the things I read, too, is that which kind of I think stuns some people, too, is it speaks to abortion. It also speaks to sterilization, which actually is crucial for a lot of women in the world today.
It certainly, I mean, it's actually, I think, barbaric to take these things away from women. It's just, it's unreal what it really does to the scope and the depth to which they try to control women's lives.
Mm-hmm. Now, one of the things that Trump supports a ban, you know, similarly, actually, he talks about he would support a ban on abortion in the U.S. And I wanted to get, you know, give people a sense of both what it means, you know, when you said that this threatens people's lives in the third world, and also what they would do here is also a threat to people's lives, to women's lives. I mean, this is there's a place where this all joins together, and that is women's lives are being put at threat. So let's talk about that a little.
You know, in the United States, even now, I mean, 20-some states have bans after the 20th week of pregnancy due to the protection of the unborn child or pain, you know, fetal pain bill. Nebraska was one of where I practiced mainly, or where my home practice is in Nebraska. They were the first state to propose and pass this law to become legislation. I personally don't think it was or is constitutional now, but it's just we had to pick our fights. And, I've been to the Supreme Court twice. I don't necessarily think that it's right for me to be the third person to go back again. But it's now in 25 states, and they're trying to, of course, now make this a national ban. And also then the bill just introduced or announced that will be introduced is to ban abortions after you see fetal heart tones, which is usually by the 8th week. And it's usually before most women even have a clue that they are pregnant. That's what we're worried about right now.
Mm-hmm. I want to remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking right now with Dr. Lee Carhart, an abortion provider, a late-term abortion provider, one of only four in the country. And we're talking about Trump, the global gag rule, and the continuing struggle to protect the right to abortion, which, by the way, is a basic human right. You know, one thing Trump has said that he supports the ban on abortion in the U.S. is, and I kept thinking about, I remember interviewing you once, and you and, you know, there's been a number of abortion providers I've spoken with. And actually, even when you were, I should tell people, you were in the, I can't remember the name of the film, but you were in a, what is the name of the film that was? After Tiller, yeah, yeah. And had very special meaning for you. In terms of Dr. Tiller and your relationship with Dr. Tiller, but also in terms of what it put forward to people about the importance of providers like yourself, which is – it is. It's extremely important. But you're also – you are in the sort of the crosshairs of this – what is beginning to happen and is going to happen in terms of what Trump says he's going to support. You told me once that one of the things that really moved you is when you thought about what it actually means in terms of women's lives that they don't have the right to an abortion. Can we talk about that a little?
Well, yeah, I mean, statistically, in, I believe, the last year or so, well, data is not available before 2014, but the last year the data is available, maybe 2013 that's been published, 2013, 2014. The death rate from abortions of all gestations is about 8 to 10 women per million, okay? The last reported death rate from pregnancy is 14 women per 100,000, or 140 women per million. So just on the basis, if a woman doesn't want to be pregnant, forcing her to remain pregnant is subjecting her to 140 times the death rate, or, you know, at least 14 to 100 times the death rate, depending on what the gestation of the abortion is done at, because most of the problems occur later in the term. And to me, that's cruel and unusual punishment to start with, to force a woman to be pregnant when she doesn't want to, because it is an unnecessary risk of life that she's taking. That's my first thing that bothers me. The second thing, that the males in this country and in most other countries, their right to abort the fetus is from day one. If they don't like a pregnancy, they walk away from it. It's gone. It's none of their business. And good luck if you can find them to force them to pay child care. That doesn't kind of happen. So, to me, it's also a women's equality issue that it should not be left up to the woman whether or not an unplanned conception is what she wants to continue. So those are my two basic fears. And then there are pregnancies, of course, that are harmful to the woman's life and place her at a great risk. And those become even more important to take care of, and especially the third thing, when you have pregnancies that are severely flawed or fatally flawed even, that it just subjects the mother to, if she doesn't want to carry to term, just added on months of agony. So, you know, it's just a multifaceted issue that should really be left to doctors and the patients and nobody else.
Mm-hmm. Now, Trump's talked about if abortion is banned in the U.S., women who have one should be punished. And then he changed that a little to say that, well, actually, we'll say that the abortion providers should be punished. Let's talk about that.
Well, before Roe v. Wade, there were doctors and midwives and lay people that were punished for performing abortions on women in the United States. But we go up north to Canada with Henry Morgenthaler, spent many years in jail because he fought for women's rights. before the Canadian laws were reversed to be actually better than ours are now. It probably will mean that the women have to go to the back alleys again and find unlicensed doctors, or not even, you know, nurses or just lay people to do their abortions. We know for a fact that abortions after Roe was made available did not increase in the country. The number remained about the same. And with abortion availability and better education with birth control and other emergency contraception, you know, we've reduced the rate of abortions to the lowest that it's been in ever right now. So unintended pregnancies in teens are way, way down because of the education and the birth control. But we have to go back to the other policy that Trump is also, they've expressed that they're totally against birth control. I mean, abortion they're going for now, but their goal is family planning, period.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things I was thinking about as you were speaking, there's a point here that when they talked about abortion providers being punished, I couldn't help but think of the number of abortion providers who have been attacked in recent years, and then in particular going back to Dr. Tiller, and who was a personal friend of yours and actually was involved in your, as you began to come into doing abortions, providing abortions for women, you became close friends with him.
Actually, I was an associate in this practice for almost from 1997 till 2009, so going on 12 years.
Mm-hmm. And the threat to you and other providers, and the threat that was carried out against him, also points to the threat to you and other providers from these forces. I mean, look, there's a lot of these Yahoo men out there following in the foot tracks of Trump and everybody else and all the stuff that's being built up around this, where, you know, somebody made the point that it kind of struck them that when they were signing the paperwork for the Mexico City thing, that there was all these guys standing around a table writing into law this thing, you know, resurrecting this law. And I kept thinking that when they talk about punishing doctors, I mean, there have been doing what you do, Lee, is not a healthy profession in one sense. You know, it's healthy mentally, and what you're doing for people, it's very good. But on the other hand, you got to be careful walking down the street at night.
Exactly. I mean, everything we do is security first. And with Dr. Tiller, he did everything possible to be secure. You know, he had bulletproof automobiles and offices and everything, but his one weakness was that he went to church every Sunday, and of course he was actually murdered in church because that was the least secure place that the assassin could get to. So, it makes it so your life is constantly, well, security is more important than anything else. And, you know, it's already a punishment to be doing abortions because of that. And they, of course, in the last 5 years, the antis have attacked the schools where my landlord kids went to school in middle school, 10th, 7th graders, that they actually go and protest the children there and with signs that their father is a Nazi and their father is a murderer because he rents space he leases space to me. So, I mean, it's to everybody that actually helps us practice. It's not just to the practitioners themselves.
Mm-hmm. I want to remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking right now with Dr. Lee Carhart, an abortion provider, a late-term abortion provider, one of only four in the country. And we're talking about Trump, the global gag rule, and the continuing struggle to protect the right to abortion, which, by the way, is a basic human right. You know, it's kind of there's something really heavy about referring to other people as murderers and all this other stuff when you look at what these people have done in terms of the killings that they've carried out, the attacks on abortion clinics, the attacks on women that have done this. I was going to ask you about this. Is there, in your estimation, is there now since, and I know it's hard to judge since since the beginning of the Trump regime, but over the last few years, has there been a growth in the anti-abortion movement? There's this anti-abortion march that they're talking about.
I haven't seen any really estimates of numbers. I think the one thing that Trump's right about is the numbers don't matter. And the reason I don't think they matter so much in this movement is because the people that are pro-choice have families and businesses, and that's what's their primary objective, where the anti-choice, they'll take off everything just to go demonstrate and be there. So I don't think the number of people that show up is overwhelmingly important. But I do expect, to be very honest, I expect a much less attendance today than there was with the rally last Saturday. but that we're going to have to wait and see what the numbers come out to be. But it's the whole thing, and I was listening to the segment just before yours where they're talking about impeaching Trump, and that's a good idea. I don't think anything's wrong with that, but the problem is that Pence, as far as abortion rights, is probably worse than Trump is. So, I mean, it's not any benefit to us. It's just that the people, you know, we need to wake up and take over now and not wait for the next elections.
Mm-hmm. You know, one thing that Trump has said, and I really totally agree with you about Pence and you know, a Christian fascist to the bone, you know, and what he does around this is like really, including what he had already done in Indiana in relation to abortion rights. One thing is Trump has said that if Roe v. Wade is overturned, then the issue of abortion rights will go to the states and things will be decided fairly. What do you think about that? What's our experience been there?
I mean, that's certainly a possibility, but I also wouldn't put it past them to try to take away the rights from the states to allow abortions and just say on a federal basis that abortion is not legal after a certain XYZ. That's what Trump's saying today, that this may happen, but what Trump says today, we found out for years, doesn't necessarily mean anything more than what it is today. Tomorrow it's probably something totally different. So I would imagine their immediate goal would be to limit it to the state decision, which will be good for some women, but it's going to be bad for right now. I'm practicing in Maryland also because that's the state that has the best laws, but now women from all over the eastern half of the United States that are further along in their pregnancies end up coming to Maryland. So It's bad for women in general, I mean, to have to make this trip. Or to restrict it to states makes it totally unjust for some women.
I couldn't help thinking when I read that, I couldn't help thinking, too, about Texas. What happened in Texas immediately as they turned it over to, well, this is a state decision. This is the state draws up all the rules. And immediately, abortion clinic after abortion clinic closed down and women were forced to travel hundreds of miles and you know, give up days of work. It became impossible, literally impossible, for many women to actually be able to go and have an abortion. And you think about what that promotes in terms of the self-inflicted abortions or whatever.
In Nebraska, where I live and practice right now, there's already a law on the book that says, you know, abortion is illegal in the state of Nebraska, but we have to allow it due to the federal laws. However, if Roe versus Wade decision is reversed, abortions become illegal in Nebraska, effective that day of a reversal. I mean, that is already passed and on our books in Nebraska. So,
Lee, we have one more question, and we do have to have you back, man. Have you back and dig into this a little bit more deeply in the future. But let's talk about this. You inspire a lot of people when you talk about why you're doing abortion. Let's talk about that.
Well, why I'm doing them right now, and to be honest, I'm 75 years old, and I want to slow down. I'm currently working 13 out of 14 days in two different states. I do it for the reasons I stated before, that I think women deserve the right to determine when and if they want to become a parent. And I just giving that equality to women, I think, is so important. And I'm working in the two states where I can do that right now. That when I went to medical school, abortion was illegal, and I was in general surgery residency. And we saw in the emergency room almost weekly women that were coming in and dying. And I have said before that in the hospitals I worked at in Philadelphia in the 69 to 75 era, we had more women die in a week in Philadelphia from abortions that were performed poorly. And granted, some of them were back alley. Most of them were self-attempted or friends taking care of friends. But we saw more women dying a week in one city than we see dying in a year from abortions today when it's legal. And making them illegal again is not going to reduce the number of abortions done. That's been proven over and over in many societies. It's just going to produce the quality of the abortions and control what the actual risk to the woman is besides abortion. And for many, many women, it seems really unusual, but to them, dying is a better option than carrying the pregnancy another day. So you can say that it's the women's fault because they take the risk, but it's, you know, the risk is there. It's part of their makeup. It's part of their choice, and they will take the risk if having this child is not in their best interest. So by taking it away, we're really, really risking the lives of many, many women.
Mm-hmm. And as you once said when I interviewed you before, if not you, who? You know, and that's very important.
I think that, you know, what we'll see if they overturn abortions is, unfortunately, we'll have another war where 50,000 people die. This time it's going to be a war against women, and it's going to be young women that die, not the men in Vietnam, not the men in the East Asia.
That's very, very important. And on that note, Lee, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael.
All right. Talk to you again soon, man.
Bye-bye.
Okay, bye now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show. We've just been talking with Dr. Lee Carhart. He's a doctor performing late-term abortions, and we've been talking about the Trump regime's, actually the Fuhrer, his opening attack on abortion rights and what the fascist president has promised to do, and that is end all abortions for all women. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned.
We're told that after the war, the Nazis vanished without a trace, but battalions of fascists still dream of a master race. The history books, they tell of their defeat in 45. But they all came out of the woodwork on the day the Nazi died. They say the prisoner of Spandau was a symbol of defeat. Whilst Hess remained in prison, then the fascists, they were beat. So the promise of an Aryan world would never materialise. So why did they all come out of the woodwork on the day the Nazi died? The world is riddled with maggots, the maggots are getting fat. They're making a tasty meal of all the bosses and bureaucrats. They're taking over the boardrooms and they're fat and full of pride. And they all came out of the woodwork on the day the Nazi died. So if you meet with these historians, I'll tell you what to say. Tell them that the Nazis never really went away. They're out there burning houses down and peddling racist lies. And we'll never rest again until every Nazi dies.
All right, welcome back. That was a song I never get tired of hearing. And I hope you never get tired of hearing it as well. It's The Day the Nazi Died from Chumbawamba. Just a few hours ago, I had the opportunity to speak with Andy Z, spokesperson for Revolution Books in New York City, and one of the initiators of Refuse Fascism. And we were talking about the consolidation of the Trump-Pence regime and what it means for humanity and whether people can still drive it out. So we're going to take a listen to that call, or to that interview that we did just a couple of hours ago. So check this out. All right. It's a week since the inauguration of Trump, and the fascist is sitting in the White House. He's in power, and there's a whole lot of people wondering what the hell is going on, what are we going to do, what's the situation. And joining us today to talk about this is Andy Z. Andy is a spokesperson for Revolution Books in New York City, and he is one of the three people who really initially initiated the RefuseFascism.org and the whole movement that grew up around that over the last few weeks. And he's here to talk with us about where are we at now. Andy, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael.
Sure. Let's jump into this because I want to get as much out of it as we can in the time we have. You know, we've talked about a long time ago, well, at the end of last year, when this first became a big question, the point of actually standing up against Trump, recognizing it as him as a fascist and what would be happening if he did come to power. Now the situation has changed. Trump has, to this point, been able to consolidate his, at least stepping into the presidency. Let's talk about that in terms of the, first off, what does it mean for the character of the society right now?
Well, the fact is that he and his regime, with Trump-Pence regime, have power, and that means they have the full force of the state behind them. They're able to directly, through executive order, implement policy. They've got a Congress that's, if not completely intimidated, pretty close to it, and you know it's clear that the Democrats, who some are calling Vichy Democrats, reminiscent of the former people in power in France under occupied France when it was occupied by the Nazis in the 1930s and 40s, are going to collapse. And this, the press is not completely, but largely intimidated. So he's got power. He's got the authority of the state, and he's moving ahead. He's been throwing a lot of red meat to his fascist social base. And so we're in a very different situation where the Trump-Pence regime has its hands on the reins of power, which means most fundamentally their hands on the ability to repress dissent and to limit speech, and both of which they're moving on in terms of things they're threatening to do and some things they've actually done, including putting extremely heavy charges against protesters, including journalists, for the protests in Washington, D.C.
You know, when you look at some of the other programs that he's actually beginning, I mean, the first couple of days when he actually came out with all of his things around immigrants and the various other things that he's been talking about doing, including the Mexico City abortion, you know, move that he made, that really sort of indicating that he's actually what has been said by refusefascism.org all along has been that, look, if this guy comes in, there are going to be these series of blatantly fascistic moves that he's going to be implementing from the beginning and from the get-go, and he's going to be trying to steamroller it over the entire society. It seems to be that's the direction that things are heading in pretty rapidly.
Yeah, that's true. And yet from the beginning, Refuse Fascism said that this is going to be more than the sum of all these reactionary measures. And some of this you can see in terms of the tone and the morality and the ideology that's going to dominate society and that he's going to ram through. Everything from the matter of, he talks about and Kellyanne Conway talk about an alternative set of facts. Now, this is, you know, on one hand, it's a joke. People laugh at it. But what's really saying is that what we are going to accept as true is what we are going to say and do from the position of power. And you can even watch in Spicer's second press conference how the press began to a large extent, accept those terms. Yes, there was some pushback on some questions. But there is not a unified approach by the press to say, to ask the same question over and over again and to walk out should he continue with this. But there's a method to this madness. You see, this is very similar to what every fascist has done. It's what they say is what is. This goes along with the alternative universe that a lot of his social base has been living in. So this is an extremely dangerous thing. The morality, and even this question of the rule of law. Look, you know I'm the spokesperson for Revolution Books, and as far as I am personally concerned, and the new synthesis of communism that lies developed by Avakian is at the core of Revolution Book, you know, we believe that we live under a society that is constantly and consistently a dictatorship by the class that rules, the imperialist class. But what is being instituted here is a whole other form of that rule, which is extremely dangerous. So this is something that needs to be really understood from the beginning. If you look at the inaugural address, just to take one point, almost all the time when presidents run, they speak about, in their inaugural address, upholding the Constitution and the rule of law. If you listen closely, and even not that closely, to Trump's inaugural, he speaks of the rule of the people, which in translated into the German of Hitler is der Volk, and that the allegiance now is to the people and the movement that he built that is going to express itself through him. This is a different dynamic, which taken to its logical conclusion, including the fact that he has power, means a different way that the society is going to be ruled, even as it continues to be in the interests of the capitalist and the imperialist class. So this is a very big difference. And it really matters. It has everything to do with the kinds of resistance and the kinds of openings that exist in society for dissent, for resistance, for a rebellion, and even for revolution. All of this is of extreme import. So it's not just a matter of a succession of policies, as bad as they are, but it's a synthesis of those policies into a qualitatively different form of what we would call bourgeois rule.
Mm-hmm. I think that's extremely important for people to understand. And it makes me think about this, too, because I know a lot of people were saying, look, you know, is it really possible to do what refusefascism.org had said was necessary and what people had set out to do, which was, in fact, to stop this, basically. And, you know, right now it's people are facing this new situation where this guy has come in and he's consolidated his power and all this other stuff. And the question of, is it possible to stop it now? Is it possible? What do we do in the face of this? And people, I think, would look to that, both what happened in terms of the initial effort to prevent him from coming into power, and then second, is it possible to, what's it mean for today?
Yeah, well, that's the big question people need to get into, because we have to stop this. So on the first question of, yes, it was possible, it didn't happen. So that's something that we need to get into very deeply. In the space of 1 month, we accomplished a great deal, including, you know, just for one thing of putting that term fascism and defining it in front of millions of people. Full page ad, New York Times, full page ad, Washington Post, spokespeople on everything from allhiphop.com to Young Turks to those two newspapers, Fox TV. I understand Rachel Maddow did a whole thing the other night, or a little video thing of the no, which is a symbol that was developed by refused fascism and became very, it was all over the place through this movement. So that's just one of the things in terms of setting a different direction. But we had contended at that time that you could only stop something like this by a massive outpouring of millions of people who were refusing to leave the streets, to put it that way, and who were fighting in a certain sense, and I don't mean necessarily fighting, but even if they're out in vigils, but continually and outside the bounds of saying this is unacceptable. This is a very new thing for people in this country, and people did not do that. Yet, on the other hand, the outrage is widespread, and as we saw in the marches, the Women's March, the day after the inaugural, that there was literally, I think, 3.4 million people out in the streets of this country. So there is the widespread disgust and hatred and desire for this to change. So that was, one, the sea of people that we were trying to mobilize into a form of protest prior to the inaugural and more sustained. We were not able to do that in that period of time, and people were not ready for that. And now the task in front of us is to see how that could be mobilized again on a more sustained basis. And there's where there are differences in program going forward. So if you want to get into then how we could do it going forward, we could talk a little bit about that.
All right, let me take a minute to remind listeners that we're talking with Andy Z, the spokesperson for Revolution Books in New York City, and one of the original initiators of refusefascism.org. Yeah, I do. I want to get into the differences of program that you were just talking about. I think it's actually important. How do we actually do this? Because I think that is a big question people are looking at. It's like, okay, we put into this. How do we actually – there's a new juncture. There's a new situation we're in. How are we actually going to do this now? How do we do this going forward?
Well, okay. So for all those who were following Refuse Fascism or checking it out, and for those who threw their heart and soul into it for the last month, I think one of the first things you have to do is – and that we all have to do collectively over the next couple of weeks – is take stock of what we actually did do, what we said, what we accomplished, and then really try to take a close look at what resonated, what didn't, why didn't it resonate, and come to a summation of this last period that would enable us to understand what we did do and where either we fell short through errors or where people themselves didn't themselves yet understand the nature of what they were up against. So this is still remains something that has to, a process that has to go on. That's number one. And, you know, you have to analyze this. There's a lot of people who are out in the streets who say we have to prepare grassroots organizing like the Tea Party to take the Congress back. Well, is that going to work? How does that mobilize people? How does that demobilize people? And, in fact, if you really come to grips with it's a fascist regime, I think it would evidence that that's foolish at best, because why do you think he's making all this fuss about the illegal voting, which is clearly a fabrication of his? Because he wants to further restrict voting rights, further rewrite districting, further restrict access, so that they do lock in a majority, because fascists will always prefer to come to power and to exercise their rule through what would be seen as legitimate ways while changing the actual mechanisms of what I would call bourgeois, and we would call bourgeois democracy. Now, Refuse Fascism, you know, is an organization that involves many people who believe very deeply in the system and want to return it to that. That's a very important point, and it's a broad coalition in that sense. But the second point is, including right now, we have to keep our eyes peeled for developments that could actually bring out millions of people in a more sustained way, because the rage and outrage and the reality of what's happening is beginning to dawn on people. So I don't want to get too much into specific scenarios, but you could have a situation where he does take a measure just one step too far. There could be an attack on a section of people that strikes the outrage of people. I mean, just think of some of the things that happened in the Black Lives Matter movement or that sparked that movement. Trayvon Martin, who would have thought? Just one kid down south, nobody ever heard of him, a small Florida town, and then a nationwide movement grows up around that. I think in this situation, things like that could happen that encourage people to not just come out in their millions in one day of protest, but to say, now's the time, we have to stop it. So people in refuse of fascism, as well as people much more broadly, need to be attuned to those kinds of developments where what we were aiming for before this could become possible. And the sooner the better, because they are going to cement into place some pretty repressive stuff. Mm-hmm. You know, including, I just might take one more moment here, he's already threatened to bring the feds, as he put it, into Chicago. Well, who is that going to be aimed at? It's going to be aimed at the people who suffer the most under this system, in part because that's people that he and people like him fear the most.
Mm-hmm. And that's a really important point, I think. I mean, I was thinking about this point that you've raised in the letter that you, Carl, and Sansara wrote, and this point of the point that is made about this new juncture and the fact that there is, you know, look, the normal workings of the system is one thing, but when you have this in terms of a fascist in power, the possibility of crisis is something people have to be keenly attuned to and actually understand what doors might open or might not open in relation to this, but really understanding that the juncture here and where they need to go now, where things need to go now, and what are the consequences of not – what are the consequences of actually missing that? There's sort of consequences that humanity should not have to face, okay?
Yeah, you're right. This is – he's doing things now that threaten the future of humanity. On climate, he's totally rewriting the book on international relations. He says, you know, he's going by the – he's advocating war crimes, and they're actually instituting measures – potentially, apparently, reauthorizing black sites and torture. And let alone, you have to remember, he has his hand on the nuclear codes and has actually speculated about why don't we use these weapons. So this is an extremely dangerous situation, but in its danger, in the extremeness of the situation, also lies the potential for millions of people to act. But there will be a necessity to try and act soon, and we're going to have to develop the ways to do that, including there's some very positive protests around immigration the last two nights in New York and L.A. and different cities around the country. I think some stuff in the Southwest, Denver and places like that. So this is a very positive development. I think refused fascism itself will have to regroup and itself call for things. But the most important thing is to be prepared, especially now, for sudden changes in the situation and to be able to seize on them, to be able to, at this point, we're going to have to drive our regime out. And that was, I think, one of the sticking points for people of, well, how do you do that? He was elected, and people are going to have to take another look at, you know, as we said in the call for refuse fascism, no election, whether fair or fraudulent, should legitimate a regime that is illegitimate because of what it stands for and what it will do. And now we can add what it is actually doing.
Mm-hmm. All right, Andy Z, I want to thank you very much for joining us today. And we'll have you back, man. We've got to follow this continuously, man, because it's not something that can be just sort of spoken to in a minute and dropped. So definitely come back, all right?
Okay, you're doing good work, Michael. Thank you.
Thanks, man. Bye-bye. Take care. Bye. That was Andy Z, the spokesperson for Revolution Books in New York City and one of the initiators of Refuse Fascism. We're going to take a quick break and be right back to talk about what the hell is going on with the immigrants' right issue and Trump, all right? So check this out.
Smash the system. Let's go down to the riot, it's summertime. And now's the time to smash the system.
Smash the system.
Smash the system.
Smash the system.
Got the numbers, roll up a number, let's have an adventure on the escalator.
All right, I confess, I just had to get that in here, all right? I would play it much longer, but we don't have that much time, and so I want to jump into this because my next guest, I've been really looking forward to talking with him. His name is Ahilan Arulanantham, and he's the director of advocacy, legal director at the ACLU of Southern California, and a former senior staff attorney at the ACLU Immigrant Rights Project. Ahilan, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Sure. Let's jump into this, man. One of the central themes of Trump's whole program is his clampdown on immigrant people. And he's repeatedly ranted about how central this crackdown is on what he calls illegal immigrants. And he's and it's all part of his Make America Great. Well, just recently, one of the big things he did was he put up what he's planning to do about this. What's your take on the overall assault as it rolled out this week?
I think what he did this week with the two executive orders on immigration is very consistent with what the campaign rhetoric was. But I think what's so striking is that it's an attempt to enact sort of all the worst, most draconian immigration enforcement policies all at once. And I think the scale of and the ambition of the crackdown that is envisioned in those orders is really striking. You know, even if you heard all of the statements and believed all the statements that he, you know, the racist statements and blatantly anti-immigrant statements that he made in the campaign, I still think it's just surprising to see the whole thing manifested so clearly in two documents, and apparently more to come, but at least in those two documents.
Yeah, it's surprising and it's bone-chilling as well. And when you think about this, I mean, this is the cat who is sitting up there, and he's controlling the largest, most powerful imperial country to ever exist in the world. And he's aiming, taking aim at all the things that actually are things that people are doing for survival. And he's basically taking aim, like in relation to this, at a whole people who simply are doing what they need to do to survive. And he talks about he's fixing what's gone wrong. To me, it's just that, you know, people have to recognize what this is. It's an assault against a whole section of people that have been deemed criminal by him.
Yeah, I think it's an assault on families. It is because so many of the people who are targeted by the set of orders, and like you want to say, oh, these are criminals. That's the sort of rhetoric used in the order. But aside from the fact that, you know, that category is very broad and it's often used to refer to people, I mean, the order attempts to refer to anybody who's arrested, basically, can fall into that category. You know, but you can't escape the fact that we're talking about people who are living in families with parents and children and siblings who, in many cases, have lived in this country for decades. Many of the people targeted by this order are living here lawfully under the immigration laws. They have green cards. And as you say, many of the other people, whether they're, you know, it's lawful under the existing immigration law or not, they've lived here for decades. And the majority, vast majority of the American public actually recognizes that there needs to be some rational way of legalizing those people over time. But this is not an administration which is acting consistent with what the majority of people think on the subject. They really are on the extreme fringe when it comes to immigration policy, and a lot of other things too, I think, but certainly when it comes to immigration policy, they're on the extreme fringe, and they're really enacting the far right anti-immigrant agenda on that set of issues.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's look at a couple of these things. There's the one, a couple of the directives so far. The one is border security and immigration enforcement improvements and interior immigration enforcement. Let's look at the border security and immigration enforcement improvements first. What's that actually mean in the world today?
Well, there's a number of things in that order and also in the other one. And I think in some ways it makes sense to think about them as a kind of coherent whole. But I think the three core things that these are doing, the first one, the border one, the number one thing it's doing more than anything else is it's trying to massively expand the number of people who are detained in the immigration detention system. And that's a system that already massively expanded under President Obama. So it's actually well over 40,000 people every day. We're talking about a small city's worth of people are living in these immigration detention centers. These are all people who are not there for any kind of crime. The vast majority of them actually now have not been convicted of a crime. But even those that have been convicted of a crime were then, they finished serving their sentence, but now are then separately arrested by immigration and put there. And he wants to massively increase the size of that. He wants to build new detention centers, send the judges to the detention centers so that you can sort of run the whole thing, the whole court process, immigration court process out of the detention centers. So that's one very large aspect of it. Another large asset, which is also in the first one, the border enforcement executive order, is to try to find ways to deport people without giving them hearings in front of judges. So there are a couple of different provisions there which are really aimed at trying to short-circuit the immigration judge and immigration court process as a whole and find them, they say, you know, consistent with law, the maximum possible way, consistent with law, to kick people out of the country without even giving them a day in court. So that's another thing that it does. And then I think the third thing that I would say out of that order, which is very important, is there are a number of steps taken that are targeted specifically at asylum seekers. This is people who are coming to the border, fleeing often the most violent countries in the world, like the Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, but also people coming from all over the globe, coming to the border and asking for asylum. And, you know, just like Jewish people did in World War II, which is what really led to the creation of the Refugee Convention. You know, that same act of coming to the border, whether by boat or by land, and asking for protection. And this order tries to basically, it did a number of things. One thing it tries to do is turn them back, let them stay outside the U.S. while we take our time in deciding whether they're asylum case. Another thing it does is it tries to detain them, so lock them all up. Now some of them get locked up and others of them get released, and it wants to try and increase that to lock them basically all up while their cases are pending. And it also just in a sort of naked way, I think almost it's trying to just deny more of them. It's going to try to interpret the laws more narrowly to deny asylum to more of those people. But those are, I think, the most disturbing parts. This is a stiff competition. You know, there's a lot of nasty stuff in that order. But I think those are, in my view, the sort of most disturbing parts of the border one. Then, I mean, I'm talking to you for a long time.
Well, let me ask you one question real quick before you get into the next thing. It seems to me that related to what you've just been talking about, too, though, is this just amping up of the militarization of the border and the actual border army that's down there now, you know, 5,000 border patrol, 10,000 immigration officers. This is a mid-sized army he's got going.
Yes, and if you live in the border region, it is really a fundamentally different experience from living in Los Angeles or in lots of other parts of the country. People already living in southern parts of California, in Tucson, in El Paso, in Las Cruces, New Mexico, there are Border Patrol vans driving around on the regular streets. And in many cases, they pull people over. The traffic stops, like what would happen to you if you were speeding on, you know, the freeway. Border Patrol pulls people over in regular traffic stops and asks them about their immigration status. And then they go into people's houses. And it's all kinds of abuses that have been documented for years with the Border Patrol. And instead of taking the lessons from that, which is really threatening the liberty of so many people, including many American citizens who are living in the border region, the lesson that they've taken is, oh, we want to do more of that to chase a phantom, you know, immigration wave, which actually doesn't even exist. So, yeah, that's the border ramp up is another very deeply troubling. You know, like I said, there's a lot of things that are wrong with the executive orders, and that's another one of them.
Mm-hmm. I want to remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. And we're talking right now with Ahilan Arulanatham, the Director of Advocacy, Legal Director at the ACLU of Southern California, and a former senior staff attorney at the ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project. And we're talking about Trump's first moves to attack immigrants. Well, one thing I was wondering about, too, is that, and you've spoken to this somewhat, but you know, this thing about the Secure Communities Program, this is like, you know, what the hell is he talking? You know, it just makes your blood boil, you know, and your tongue get stuck on your teeth because he's talking about this. And it's give people a sense of what that actually will mean. I mean, the concretes of it.
Yeah, so that is what I would say in the second memo, the interior memo, although it's referenced in both. The engine, one thing that these orders make clear is the engine for the mass deportation machine that Trump wants to create is not only going to be the things that I mentioned already, the increase in detention and then trying to deport people without hearings. It's also going to involve an attempt to bring entirely into the federal immigration enforcement bureaucracy all the state and local law enforcement officers. That is the striking thing about the order. The order said it is now the policy of the U.S. federal government to engage in state and local law enforcement cooperation on immigration enforcement. And the Obama administration tried that in a much more limited way compared to what this order contemplates through secure communities and through some other programs as well. And they were disastrous. And what secure communities was a program where basically every time a police officer arrested somebody, their arrest information, like their fingerprints and that kind of information, would be shared with federal immigration officials so that if the person could be put into the deportation process, then immigration would know that and then go out and begin that process. And it's completely disastrous because obviously that discourages people from having contact with law enforcement. Because if you think, for example, in a domestic violence situation, it's very sad, but it's very common. And when that happens, the police will often arrest both people, both, I think, sometimes for cooling off, but also try and sort out. You get competing allegations, right, of who's doing what. Well, under the program, any person who is arrested has their information sent to immigration. So what does that do? It obviously prevents victims of domestic violence who have concerns about their immigration status. And concerns can come for a variety of reasons, right, whether you're lawfully present or not. It deters them from reporting the crime. And that's just one example. It's not just domestic violence, although that's obviously a very serious problem. It's all kinds of crimes will be underreported because victims of the crimes will be scared to report them. And that's actually the reason why there was a revolt, even under the Obama administration, by police chiefs and other state and local law enforcement officials all around the country against secure communities because it was undermining public safety. And again, the Trump administration completely ignoring that history from the last few years, instead wants to double down on this in a huge way and essentially make every law enforcement officer in the country a immigration cop. And that is both, you know, it's a horrible use of resources by police officers, but it is also extremely frightening to people who have any concerns about their immigration status that are driving all around. And in Los Angeles, you've got, you know, a million undocumented people who are part of the fabric of our society. And those people are now going to be under threat if this gets implemented. You know, there's going to be a lot of resistance to this in the state and at the local level. But that's, I think, what the fight over that is coming.
Mm-hmm. Now, what about Dreamers? I know this is something that a lot of people have said, wait a minute, all these people who put their faith in this idea of that if they just came forward and turned it, gave, I mean, these people have given everything over, where they live, who they are, the, whatever ID they have. What about them in relation to this whole thing?
So thus far, there has not been an executive order specifically about Dreamers and people who came forward and got the status that President Obama made available through the DACA program. And there was a floated, what may have been a draft, but you know, it was a leak and then no one knew if it was a real order or not. And my preference is actually not to speculate about, enough to talk about what the orders that already are there. But, you know, obviously, what I suspect is that there was a massive debate going on within the administration about whether or not to take that even sort of one step further to all what they've done already and actually also specifically go after DACA recipients or Dreamers. Right. And as a result, for whatever reason, that hasn't nothing on that has come down one way or the other yet.
All right. Let me ask you one last question, and we'll have to be a little bit quick on it, but sanctuary cities. There has been a lot of stuff involved coming from Trump about actually attacking sanctuary cities.
Yes. So the Interior Enforcement Order.
And tell people what sanctuary cities are too, okay?
Sanctuary cities are essentially the resistance to what we were just talking about earlier, secure communities and other attempts to get state and local law enforcement officers to be involved in federal immigration enforcement. And essentially a sanctuary city is a city that creates policy preventing its law enforcement officials from participating in this massive immigration crackdown by saying, look, we're going to enforce the laws of public safety. We're not going to enforce the immigration law. We don't share information about immigration status with the federal government. And that's what Los Angeles's policy has been. It's really largely the state of California's policy and a number of other cities and states as well. And one of the things that the order tries to do is see if there are ways. So it doesn't yet do it, but it asks to kind of, it directs the DHS secretary and other officials to try to find a way to punish cities and states that do that financially by trying to figure out if there's a way to take away federal funding for law enforcement and for potentially other things by designating them as cities that are violating or trying to interfere with federal immigration law enforcement. And I think you hear the Republicans and the conservatives in general talk about states' rights. And here you have a situation where the state wants to go one way and the federal government is going to try to prevent that from happening and use all of its power to restrict the state's power to protect its people. And there's going, I suspect there will be a lot of legal fights over that because a lot of people in California think that the federal government cannot do that.
Mm-hmm. All right, Ahilan, I want to thank you very much for joining us. And I still have a bunch of things I want to ask you about what's going on in the Middle East in relation to all this. So we'll have you back soon, okay?
I would love that.
Thanks, okay, great, man. All right, take care now. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we've just been talking with Ahilan Arulanatham, and he's the Director of Advocacy, Legal Director at the ACLU of Southern California, and former Senior Staff Attorney at ACLU Immigrants' Rights Project. All right, that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all of my guests today, Dr. Lee Carhart, Andy Z, and Ahilan Arulanatham. I'd also like to thank my assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer, Kiana Williams. And I want to be sure to thank each and every one of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. And if you're interested in helping to work on the show, we got 1,001 things that people can help in doing. And so just write to me there and say, hey, I want to do something, and we'll be in touch with you right away. Now, I'm going to cut the show off right now because there's a song here that I want people to get a chance to hear this song, or at least hear as much of it as you can right now, because it's just that powerful. And the song is Immigraniata, We Come in Rougher by Gogo Bordello. Check this out.
Emigrada, emigraniada, emigrada, emigraniada, da, emigrada, emigraniada. We're coming rougher every time.
We're coming rougher, we're coming rougher.
We're coming rougher every time.
Hey, 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 hey.
We're coming rougher every time.
Emigrada, emigraniada, emigrada, emigraniada, emigrada, emigraniada.
We're coming.
Corridors full of tear gas, our destinies jammed every day, like deleted scenes from Kafka, flash down the bureaucratic train. But if you give me the invitation to hear the bells of freedom chime, to hell with your double standard, we're coming rougher every time.
We're coming rougher, we're coming rougher,
we're coming rougher every time.
Hey, 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 hey,
we're coming rougher.
To them we got nothing to say. Our emigrada, emigraniada, for them a Don Quixote's kind of way. But if you give me the invitation to hear the bells of freedom chime, to hell with your double standard, we're coming rougher every time.
We're coming rougher, we're coming rougher,
we're coming rougher every time.
Hey, 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 hey,
we're coming rougher. Start again from zero. It's a book of true stories, true stories that can be denied. It's more than true, it actually happened. It's more than true, it actually happened. It's more than true, it actually happened.